you?
My name is Bond.
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 James Bond.
Welcome, James.
Spectre?
It's been a long time.
Ah, it's your Spectre against mine, huh?
But finally, here we are.
Yes, I thought I saw a Spectre at your shoulder.
You made a mistake, my friend.
Well, we wouldn't want that, would we?
This cuckoo made me realize my father's life had to end. In a way, he's responsible for the path I took. So thank you, cuckoo.
Don't say it! The writing's on the wall.
Welcome to the Hollywood Gauntlet.
I'm a member of Spectre.
Spectre?
Spectre. Special Executive for Counterintelligence, Terrorism, Revenge, Extortion.
Spectre.
Spectre.
Let us now proceed with new business. You will hear from number two, who is in charge of our NATO project. The most ambitious Spectre has ever undertaken. Your report, number two.
From the ashes of Skyfall, the 9-year quest for James Bond to discover the secret of Spectre has finally been revealed.
Cuckoo.
I'm your host, John Jansen. Welcome to the Hollywood Gauntlet. Joining me for this Spectre-shaken discussion are John Hargrove.
Number seven.
Are we trying to take Bond to the next point? Are we trying to look back at previous Bonds?
Michael Stevens.
Number 10.
The writing's on the wall, all right. The writing's on the bathroom wall.
And Rick Silva.
Number 11.
Geez, you know, when I walked out of the theater of this movie, I was thinking, you know, it's not bad. I didn't think I wasted my money with it. You guys ruined this fucking movie for me. I mean, holy shit, I don't even like it anymore.
Our expectations were considerably higher, number 11. We will now proceed with the area financial reports.
The year is 2015. The film is James Bond 24. Assignment, Spectre. Directed by Sam Mendes. Written by John Logan, Neil Purvis, Robert Wade, and Jez Butterworth. Four writers. The return of Daniel Craig.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
So here we are. We're diving right on into Bond 24, which now we're in the new serialized, expanded Bond universe.
You made a mistake, my friend.
So we're really making a sequel to Skyfall.
Yes, but it's called the future, so get used to it.
We have the Skyfall team back. The billion-dollar grocer of Skyfall ensured that Sam Mendes and cohorts would be back for another Bond installment. The Bond producers waited an extra year to secure the services of Mendes to lure him back. Thomas Newman is back on the score. Without Roger Deakins on the cinematography, it is pretty much the same Skyfall team coming in, and also without Adele, but we'll get to that here in a little bit. But coming right off, finally, as a Bond fan, what I've been waiting for since Casino Royale is the opening gun barrel. Now, this might be a nitpicky, tiny little thing, but as a Bond fan, that was always like the overture moment that just let me settle in my seat and get ready for the new Bond adventure. I like seeing the new Bond and how he was going to turn around and fire, and I always like to see where the iris ended up. It would bounce around the screen and then it would come off to the new location. And generally, it was going to be a really good shot. Bond was not going to skimp on the money and the locale, and they were going to show you a really grand something that opened off on that. And one of my favorites, of course, is the opening of Fear Eyes Only that opens up off the grave of Teresa Bond. It's just such a nice, sweet touch before we get into the helicopter action that film would have. And, you know, we'll talk more about helicopter action here real shortly. But then something odd happened. They fade out right on the blood coming down on the gun barrel, and then they go to black. And the music cue hits, and then there's this text, "The dead are alive," come on the screen. And then they just cut to this float right there in the parade, and they start, which is this long, unbroken take that opens up the movie. Now, as a Bond fan, me personally, this is, and I may be in the minority here, but I didn't like it. I didn't like mucking up with tradition. I think they had a real opportunity to open up in a traditional way to kind of give a Craig opening that would kind of fit in with everything else. And I think the reason they didn't do that is sort of what is the assignment and sort of what is the intentions behind this? It's not to do that. It's to muck it up and do something different with Bond. We're going to move him into all these other directions while yet at the same time winking and nodding to Bond's past and previous things that we've seen in other installments, specifically bringing back the Spectre organization and its main villain.
I am Ernst Stavro Blofeld.
Spectre.
The man you're talking to now, the man inside your head, is Ernst Stavro Blofeld.
Catchy name.
So, you know, for years this was locked under the Kevin McClory clause because he helped write that with Ian Fleming. So they didn't have access to Spectre or Blofeld. And For Your Eyes Only, I thought, always dealt with that so beautifully by just dumping him in his wheelchair right on down that chimney stack, and we're done with him. And really, Mike Myers really, I think, put him to rest with the Austin Powers series anyway. But it was important for the Bond producers to get the rights back and pay money to secure that, those little loose ends, and they did. And they are now wrapped up into this sequel of Skyfall, and we have Spectre. So, opening gun barrel.
Well, I was actually happy that we had the gun barrel because we haven't had it yet in the Craig series, except for, like, that first part in Casino Royale, right?
One of my favorite, the origin of the gun barrel. And when it didn't happen in that movie, I was like, uh-oh, what's going on here? Opening up in black and white. But that movie so delivered and just kept building upon itself. And when he turned around in that bathroom and delivered it to me, I threw my hands up and went, yeah, that's great. Why didn't I do that for this moment, Inspector? I don't know. I don't cheer for that. I kind of go, that did nothing for me.
Well, you know, walking into this movie, I'm like, all right, this is another Bond I'm seeing in a theater. I know I'm going to get a bunch of stuff. I know I'm going to get good locations that I haven't seen before, and I'm going to get something new, something visually that I haven't seen before. Now, with the gun barrel scene, that's fine. I really enjoyed it because I haven't seen it yet in a Craig one except for the first one, so that was cool. But you're right, after it went black and it said, you know, the dead are alive, you don't really know where that's coming from yet, so it did throw you off a bit.
And I'd like to hear Thomas Newman's take on it, too. That's always the composer who takes on Bond. How they do that opening gun barrel is an important part of their score.
But it is great, the fanfare, you know, the Bond fanfare you get at the beginning of the movie. I did miss that, and it was good to have it back.
Well, Skyfall has the gun barrel, but it's at the end of the film. So I'm confused going into this movie. And I wonder what it was like sitting in the writer's room with the creative team and going, okay, what are we trying to accomplish here? Are we trying to take Bond to the next point? Are we trying to look back at previous Bonds? I don't think that this gun barrel bothered me nearly as much as it bothered you.
I enjoyed seeing the opening gun barrel again. It was pretty much most of what came after it that I had a problem with.
Am I crazy for that little hiccup? I should just like, okay, that's no big deal. But why couldn't they give it to me? Why do I have to be denied that as a Bond fan?
Well, I think at this point of it, you're just so upset with the film in general, you're just nitpicking that little thing. If it had been awesome, you'd have been like, ooh, they kind of tweaked convention a little bit and it was cool. But because it wasn't awesome, you're like, man, I hate when they tweak convention a little bit.
It's like when you deliver the goods, I'm there. I stayed away from trailers. I strayed away from spoilers on this film.
Totally.
I didn't want to know what the action set pieces were in this. I wanted to go in as blank as possible. So when the gun barrel happened, it just kind of was like, ooh, that's an odd note. And I evaluated it and I went, I didn't like it. I would have loved to iris off that float. It just seemed like that would have been a great opening shot. To go into the unbroken take, I think, would have been a better piece of film grammar.
Sure, man. Nothing hurts when you win. I mean, you know, it all looks good in hindsight if it works. But it just didn't quite work.
Go back and take a look at the outline for the script. I mean, before we even have a scene one, gun barrel, Bond, blood, iris opens on the eye socket of a skull. Now, John, if that had been what you were presented, if that had been the way this film opened, do you think you would have still had this uneasiness that, you know, from moment one, we're not even 60 seconds into this movie yet, and you've already shuffled in your seat once?
Just once. No, my next uneasiness came from this unbroken shot that is getting a lot of attention and acclaim. And, you know, we're in a post-Birdman world now. we can do this kind of stuff digitally. It's not that difficult anymore to digitally stitch shots together to where it looks like a single continuous take. And if you look at that shot closely, you can see where the stitches are. That point doesn't really matter. What matters most is what happens in the shot. And to me, it's just like a long piece of shoe leather. I mean, Bond clocks his opponent and then spends a long time walking down the street, into this building, up these stairs, down this hallway, into an elevator, all the way up the elevator, down this hallway, and then into a room, and then he reveals himself. Now, this is beautiful, elegant, classical filmmaking. And, you know, if you use the Hitchcock, I guess, approach, you're supposed to, it's like the ticking bomb. It's luring you in. But it's not really that, because it didn't start off with a ticking bomb and then everything happening off. We're still waiting to see what happens. We're not sure if that's Bond, but we did pay our money to see a new Bond movie, so it shouldn't be that hard for us to figure out that that might be him. Especially by the time in the elevator when he's having that FaceTime with the girl. But my point of this shot is I didn't think it was that exciting until he stepped out on the ledge. Then it took off because it's a real Bond moment. Craig's on the ledge, and it's a stunning shot from that point on with everybody in the streets, in the production design. It's a terrific-looking shot from there. So for me personally, you could have panned from the float to him on the ledge and probably had the same ultimate effect as when he stepped out on the ledge on that unbroken take. Now, when I think of great unbroken takes, I think of something like Tony Jaa in The Protector, where in that film, you'll see him going up 6 flights of stairs and take on 30 or 40 guys, and there's a threat at every corner, and he's got to use different kind of styles and techniques to take care of each one, and they're flying over banisters and balconies, and it's all unbroken, so the choreography of not only the action, but of the camera, and the reason why you do it in single take is to impress upon that's not being faked. We're not using editing to fake all this action. It's all happening right here in front of you, and it's really damn impressive. In this movie, it just feel like we were just following Bond with a long take. We got an impressive walk on a balcony, and then we go all the way behind him with this gun, and then it kind of really stops there. So, yeah, it's not like it's bad work or anything, but I really didn't feel like the bleached out look of it really helped either. I thought that was kind of odd to use that sort of bleached out tone, but I don't know. What do you think?
I think Rick nailed it, actually. You go to a Bond movie to see things you've never seen before, and what they're able to accomplish, I think, in that establishing shot is a world that we don't see every day, and the costumes and the fanfare and what was going on. And while it may not have had as much tension as what it could have, I think they accomplished what they set out to do. And then, like you said, it absolutely does take off once he gets up on the roof.
Yeah, I think this shot is indicative of the entire film. It's going to be really elegant and classical and good-intentioned, but it's going to be a lot of long walks to nowhere.
It's also good it happened at the beginning of the movie, because if this happened, like, you know, 2 hours into it and my ass is hurting, I would have hated this scene.
So, okay, if you want to talk, if you're clocking me in this Bond movie, when he's walking on that ledge, I'm locked in. It's great. Thomas Newman's score is kicking in, and I can see the crowd. It feels big. It feels like a Bond movie. I mean, yeah, you're getting your echoes of Moonraker because you had all the big festival scenes in that film.
And you have your first nod back, too, because it looks a lot like some of the costumes in this look a lot like a costume that we saw in Live and Let Die.
That goes back into your whole deja vu theory, John, about the echoes of the past and so forth. And then that counters with Maya. You're putting so much time and thought of echoing all the past Bond movies, and you fucked up the gun barrel. That bewilders me, you know? I'm vexed. I'm incredibly vexed by it.
I knew this would set you off, because after this, the movie's tainted for you. I knew it.
But here's my next shift. Okay, you get this beautiful, elegant shot. Bond sets up the gun, and he can listen in on the other people having this conversation. Bond does something really sloppy here. His laser is seen in the smoke of the two men. Now, his target is the guy on the left in the white suit. Bond waits to shoot this guy way too long. He lets them actually do a little toast, and that's how he reveals himself, because they see the laser. But my problem is the moment Bond is found out and they look at him, Bond shifts the gun to the right and shoots the other guy, not his target. Who is this guy? Dalton would have made the shot.
Thank you.
Brosnan would have made the shot. Connery would have made the shot. I don't understand why Craig was so flummoxed there and didn't take his shot.
Well, what we don't know is why is he hunting him? He doesn't know. We don't know yet why he has these orders or what's going on. And he just heard a new piece of information that a stadium's going to blow up. So maybe he wanted to save him to interrogate him a little bit more. That was my thinking of it.
And see, you're absolutely right. In the moment of the movie, that's how you should be thinking, because that's the information the movie gave you. But when you find out later that Bond was sent there to kill that guy and go to his funeral, then that's not really the case.
He was playing chess with the moment, maybe. If he took his shot on the mark and had to leave and leaves that guy's bodyguard alive, it may create problems for him down the line. So taking the bodyguard out first, then taking out the real target, maybe that was the strategy that he was going for.
Well, that was the guy he was meeting, not a bodyguard. So they both had the same information about the bomb and the stadium. So he could have taken out one and he'd had the other to get and gather any information. I just felt like if his assignment is to take out the guy in the white, he deliberately didn't for the sake of the movie. So we could draw out this sequence, of course. So that way the building can come down again with a building coming down. Didn't I see that in Casino Royale? And then we can have the chase through the crowd and then get to the helicopter scene, which is the set piece of the opening sequence. And there's no doubt that when you fly a helicopter over 3,000 people and photograph it beautifully, it's going to look impressive. But I'm sorry, seeing CGI barrel rolls and corkscrews of a helicopter does nothing for me in a Bond movie in 2015. Not when I go back and watch the opening of For Your Eyes Only and I see a helicopter doing really dynamic things for real. I see stunt guys really hanging out on the outside of that. And we all always gave the Bond movies when it cut to the close-up of Roger Moore or Connery or whoever, and they were against a blue screen for a couple of seconds. And then you always got the wide shot again that sold you the reality of the moment. And that was the interesting sort of dichotomy or dynamic that Bond movies had was, yes, they were these big escapist fantasies, and sometimes they had these ridiculous plots and scenarios and situations. But that stunt when that skier went off the cliff was real. When that boat did the jump and Live and Let Die, that was real. When that car did that corkscrew in Man with the Golden Gun, it was real. When those guys jump out the plane without a parachute in Moonraker, it's real. The guy hanging off the cliff in For Your Eyes Only, that's a great cliff climb. That's an impressive stunt. The guy hanging onto the plane in Octopussy, impressive stunt. We hadn't seen those gags before, any of them. They were put on film, even the guy on the top of the Golden Gate Bridge. It's an impressive looking stunt, and that's what we expect from Bond. We come to the Bond movies because we know Bond knows they have to up the gag and the ante. And I just feel like, what's the difference between a digital corkscrew helicopter and, you know, Pierce Brosnan snowboarding with a digital, you know, avalanche behind him? To me, they're aesthetically more or less the same, even though one effect might be a little bit better than the other. It's still digital fakery in the Bond world pulls me out of the movie more than anything. You could have taken out the corkscrew and forget your homage to Man with the Golden Gun, don't need it, and just done some really intense helicopter flying. That would have impressed me more, and if you'd have done it for real and shot it for real, I didn't need the corkscrew.
You know, it wasn't that bad. I mean, I still liked it. I thought that, you know what, even if they had a projection in the back of Daniel Craig, like how they did with, you know, Roger Moore and all that, that would have been a nice homage.
Did those effects look finished to you?
You know what I was looking for? A shadow on the ground of the helicopter. That's what I'm thinking as I'm looking at the digital part, and I'm like, they didn't bother putting a shadow on the ground.
When I think they spent $275 million on this, $300 million, and I see the effects of Craig hanging off the helicopter fighting the guy, those effects don't look done to me. That looks like the temp. That like this is the what we're going for, but it's going to look better when we're done kind of version. I don't like it when shots take me out of the moment for too protracted long of a time. Some of those just, I don't know. And I've only seen the film once, and I should probably state that. I may have a completely different view on this when and if, and if I ever get to see it again.
Well, get on with it then. Nothing can be as painful as listening to you talk.
But you can only go on your first reactions. And I haven't missed a Bond assignment since 1977. I've been very consistent. And I love this series. I mean, I can even remember I wanted to love License to Kill so much because I loved Dalton so much. I wanted him to work as Bond. I wanted him to be successful as Bond. And I remember seeing License to Kill, and it was like, you know, it was just gnawing at you that it's really not that good. You know, it's really not. I know you like Dalton, but Sanchez, it's just not that good. And so eventually you have to wake up one day and just go, it just wasn't that good. And so
we're also influenced by how good Casino Royale was. We're kind of basing that off of, you know.
It's tough when your first assignment is that strong. And that movie hit all the elements so well, from song and opening sequence to gags. Think about the construction site gag in that. Even think about the plane chase, the chase at the airport. I mean, the gags in Casino Royale are good gags. They would go on, I think, a Bond highlight reel to showcase the entire series. To me, it's like a cheat to put that corkscrew helicopter in there in a Bond gag reel.
Right. It's not a stunt. It's a digital effect. Were there actually any that would make a top 20 best Bond stunts? Were there any in this film?
And to me, that's your first job when you get hired on to a Bond movie. I mean, to me, my idea behind the Bond director is really someone like John Glenn that just loves the series and wants to infuse it with its history, not muck it up, not try and do so much new, wants to be classical and wants it to fit in with everything else, yet at the same time, you know, put his own little touch on things. But that's the first thing you got to come up with as a Bond director is, what's the gags? And I got to watch every single Bond movie and I got to know them inside and out, because I would hope you would want your gags to be better. Think about the opening gags in Skyfall. It's actually, you get the foot chase, or you get the car chase, and then he's on the motorcycle, and then on the rooftops, and then he's on the train, and you got the big old crane on the train ripping off the back of it, and then you got a fight on top of the train. Those are all better gags than I think anything, Inspector.
Wish I could help.
I was a little underwhelmed by the opening sequence for those particular reasons. As an idea on paper, it reads great. Don't get me wrong, it reads exciting. But unless you were really going to take a helicopter out to a desert and do that corkscrew and put it on film and brag to the world that once again, we've done something with a James Bond movie that you won't see or is not common, that would have been, and then you could composite that into maybe the shot over 3,000 people. Because let's face it, you're not going to do a real corkscrew over that many people. Everyone would have their iPhones out and it'd be all over YouTube if they would have really done it. So, but I know it's been well received by other Bond fans. And this is where I have to preface this entire review, is I might be in the minority. Other Bond fans are not going to have the problems that I had with it at all. But, you know, Bond's been around 50 years now. It's got a lot of different fans, different generations. You know, everyone's got different things that they like about the films or that they want from them. James Bond will return. There'll be more installments, and I'm okay with that, you know? I always say that the next one will probably be the one for me.
Yeah, the practical effects are a hallmark of James Bond, and I agree with you. That's something that I always look forward to as well. That being said, it definitely didn't take me out of it as much as it did you, and I thought it was pretty exciting. I really didn't have as big a problem with it as you did. I guess that was in light of the bigger problems that I had later.
Well, let me ask you this. Watching the scene, isn't Bond really kind of reckless in it? Is he trying to kill all the people? Because why does he want to kill the pilot? If he kills the pilot, that copter's going down while he's still fighting the other guy. Shouldn't he take care of the one guy first and then take care of the pilot? Did anyone else see this? Do you understand what I'm saying here?
It's actually a running thing through the film for me that Bond doesn't have an end game ever with what he's doing. He doesn't seem to be thinking, and it's funny that he plays chess in the film, because he's not thinking moves ahead. All he's doing is taking care of the very next thing constantly, and he ends up having to rely on his incredibly great fortune and good luck rather than his skill at predicting outcomes, which I think is something that we've grown to know and love about. And Craig has proven that he has that, and it's something that we see where Bond looks at the situation, steps back, figures out, if I do this, this will happen. Then I can do this, so that will happen. There's a whole lot of that not happening here in this movie. What is his plan here? If the pilot dies, he's going right into the ground. He's going to die with him, right?
If he's already fighting the other guy, then he's got to deal with that guy before he can even get into the pilot seat. It's like, I guess when you're in the moment watching it, it's an action scene. You don't think much about it. I mean, Hitchcock had that old term, that refrigerator moment. It's like after you go home from the movie and, you know, you're right before you go to bed, you go to the refrigerator and then you go, hey, wait a second, that doesn't really quite work in the movie. And, you know, Hitchcock's like, well, you already got away with it by then. But what you don't want to have is that moment while you're watching the movie. You know, you don't want to be taken out that way then. Bond's moves were just kind of reckless when your assignment is right there. Dude, take care of that guy. And it's a good thing that he saw that octopus symbol on the ring, right? Because how else would he know to get the ring? Did anyone else... Was there any other clues to that ring that I missed that would have clued Bond in to getting that? Anyone? No?
No, I guess that's just, you know, something that he recognized.
First of all, if I was behind a really major secret organization, a la Quantum, a la this Spectre, that can fly under the radar where MI6 doesn't even know who they are. They got people working in their department and they don't even know it. I wouldn't put my symbol on a ring. I just wouldn't do it.
But wasn't the ring reserved for the very, very high up in the organization? And I mean, he takes it because he sees the guy when he walks into the room show it to him. Like, he shows it to the guard at the meeting. Yeah, there's something about the ring. He recognizes that it could be useful and he takes it. Now, don't get me wrong. I agree. Yeah, if you're going to try and be a secret organization, the less you advertise, the better.
Well, especially because the ring has data on it. That you'd want to make it look like it would just be like, you know, just some ring, right?
Well, yeah. And apparently later on, you know, it happens to have enough to reveal everything and everyone who's ever touched it, which is really awesome.
Information.
Information is all.
The writing really is on the wall. I did not like the opening Bond song. I had not heard it before the movie. I always like to wait. You know, that way it's being presented to me as the new Bond song with the new Bond movie and the new Bond title sequence. This is, again, like the opening gun barrel, the opening Bond action sequence, and the song and title. These are things I look forward to as a Bond fan every time out. But I gotta say, the song did nothing for me. And I was shocked by that, and I didn't even really like the opening title sequence over it. And I was thinking, well, maybe just because I don't like the song, maybe it's just not vibing and gelling for me. So maybe I need to look at it without that piece of music. But I just thought after the string of songs that they've had, I would put this down in bottom tier. Honestly, I like All Time High as a better song. It's got a sweeter, prettier John Barry melody to it.
Ooh, well, let's not get carried away now.
What stands out in this song? You think Writing on the Wall is a better song than All Time High? Really?
Oof, I don't know. I don't really want to.
Honestly, I got to put you down and play 10 times in a row, at least you get Barry's strings. I mean, it might be a weak song, but it's a better song than that one.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, I've gone into Bond films before thinking, you know, I might like the song, I might not. I'm with you. I did not hear this before the film. But also with you, I was more surprised at how I didn't like the opening title sequence. I thought it was meh. It really, that's where my tag for the rest of this film came from. It started right there. And I subtitled this film now. Is that all? Is that it?
Quite a letdown.
I was not jazzed by the song and surprisingly not jazzed by the opening sequence.
Well, the two go hand in hand whenever you see it. You know, visuals accompany the music. And, well, the music just sucked in this one. I haven't heard a worse Bond song in my life.
This never happened to the other fella.
I mean, this was just, it took me right out of the movie. I'm like, you know, I'm used to like some like Duran Duran, you know, even it should capture the year that it comes out. It should echo where we are in 2015. And if this is where we're at, I'm taking a boat somewhere else because it's horrible.
Well, I think View to a Kill, speaking of View to the Kill is one of my favorites, so...
Yeah, I'd like to hear the songs that got rejected.
Yeah, who else was up to do?
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, who else was up?
Noel Gallagher has been trying to get a Bond song done for years, but I don't know if he, you know, did one or not, submitted one. But and it's just a general, it's taste, and it comes down, this song does reflect this movie perfectly. I'm so glad this song is in this movie and not like in a Bond movie I really like. And it would be that odd thing. It's really, it goes hand in hand with the movie. It goes along with it. Somebody really likes it because there's a lot of intentional decisions that were made into this $300 million Bond movie that a lot of people sat around a table and agreed upon. And this song, they could have rejected it, but they didn't. And especially coming off the smash Skyfall from last time.
What you have is, again, trying to recapture this lightning in a bottle that Skyfall got. And so you bring back the same director. You bring back the same composer. And you don't bring back the same person to write the song and perform the song. But what you do is you take a very hot Grammy Award-winning singer and you put him in and say, you write us the song. Now, I'm not so sure as many people liked it around that table as you think, but they've already invested how many hundreds of thousands, how many millions did they pay this guy, and they're going to have to do it again to send him back into the studio. I mean, to me, this thing felt very rushed. I think he's famously been quoted as saying, I wrote that song in 20 minutes. And, you know, I'm not going to say that it shows. Yeah, I'll say it. It shows.
Shocking.
It's not a very good song. It doesn't capture any sort of vibe at all. You know, Rick mentions capturing the times. And yeah, the Duran Duran, absolutely. You have a 70s power ballad with The Spy Who Loved Me. You've got the 60s bombastic, you know. I mean, it is part of it. And this is the state of the Bond Union right here. It is just flatline. Nothing really interesting. It's in tune.
I anticipated that factor. Are you quite sure?
And, you know, looking at audio recording, you never want someone to say to you, hey, I really liked the reverb on your voice. You don't want something like that to stick out. And I really liked the reverb on that guy's voice.
You made a mistake, my friend.
I think you hit something with that lightning in a bottle with Skyfall. And that's the problem, is Skyfall was so successful. But there was a lot of factors at work with Skyfall. It was Daniel Craig's third outing. And let's face it, his first two did $600 million each. People like Craig. They want to see his next installment. It was the 50th anniversary of Bond, so there was more promotion that year towards Bond than ever before. There was the 2012 Winter Olympics, where Bond parachuted with the Queen and basically was a free commercial to a billion people about the new Bond movie coming out. And then you have the blockbuster Adele song that kicks it off into another stratosphere. Do not underestimate the amount of women or people that wanted to go see that Bond movie because they liked that Adele song. And then you toppled the good reviews. It had the best reviews of a Bond movie in a long time, the Sam Mendes factor and all of that. And I just think you had sort of a perfect storm, like when Dark Knight sort of capitalized off the success of Batman Begins and just became this sort of unique, you know, moment. And I think that just happened for Bond. The problem is it feels like they're trying to replicate that. When to me, that was validation, and that was freedom to just put Bond right back on assignment again. And you could have done the wildest, craziest Boonraker kind of thing, and you'd probably gotten away with it because you had all these other, you'd gotten rid of all that baggage between, you know, Quantum and Skyfall. It's like you tied all that up in a bow. M's office looks the exact same as it looked in From Russia with Love. You know, everything was in place. Moneypenny was in place. Q was in place. It seemed like everything was set up to send Bond on a new assignment, a new adventure. And it's like, no, we're going to do Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. You know, ooh, MI6 is going to get shut down. Bond's got to go rogue. Again.
Again.
And I know, okay, opening title sequence, all the callbacks to all the other movies and whatnot, did nothing for me. It just didn't do anything for me. And I was surprised by that. And again, maybe it was the song. But I'm just, as I my mind races through all the others, I was never wild about The Man with the Golden Gun. I like it better than this song. I mean, I don't know. I think it's 24. Something has to be, though, right? So I don't know. That just really kind of threw me off. I was not expecting not to like both the song and the opening title sequence.
Hey, Rick, was your first listen to the song in the movie, or had you heard it previously?
No, in the theater.
Well, see, and that's the thing, is none of the four of us can say that we heard Skyfall for the first time in the theater. Maybe you, John, but, you know, I mean, that song was so prevalent in whether it was the radio and across all different genres, you know, whether it was a rock station, they played it. Whether it was a pop station, they played it. Maybe not so much on country, but you could not escape that song. And that's not how it was. I actually had to seek this one out. And unlike you, John, I actually look at all the trailers that come out. I'm ready for it. I'm a glutton for punishment. I realize that. But all of the footage that I saw in the teasers and in the actual official trailers, they really got me excited to see this film. I really enjoyed everything that I saw. And then I heard that song.
'Cause the writing's on the wall.
And I started to get nervous.
As I think we all started to get nervous, because I haven't heard this song in any commercials either. It's always the Bond theme, you know. I mean, with the Adele song, with the previous movie, you heard that everywhere. I mean, it was in the commercials and everything. But with this song, that's the first time I heard it. Was sitting in the theater watching a movie for the first time, and I was just like, oh man, I can't wait for the song to be over.
I think it was telling that Thomas Newman does not use any of it in the score.
Yeah, it's never repeated.
Again, we're spoiled. Chris Cornell and David Arnold sit down and they write a song together. You Know My Name. Cornell brings his thing to it, and that way Arnold can bring it back into the score and incorporate it right into Casino Royale, and it's a home run, grand slam.
Yeah, the way it should be for a Bond movie. But no, they screwed the pooch on this one.
Yeah, it didn't seem to be incorporated into the theme as it usually is.
I think Thomas Newman is a top composer. I love his work, and I think he's done a good job on both of these Bond scores for Skyfall and Spectre. To me, it's like when Bill Conti came in for Your Eyes Only. You know, you have a new guy coming in, playing around in the Bond universe, plays around with the theme a little bit, brings some of their trademarks and their bag of tricks and musical things that are earmarks of their own work. So I don't mind that every now and then when it comes along in there. I do find myself missing the romanticness that David Arnold was able to put into his scores as a callback to Barry. He always was respectful of the sides of Bond to make sure it always had that sort of lush strings and horns feeling too. And I think you can hear that on his score specifically. Not so much the intention of Newman's. And again, change up is good in those kind of areas, you know, and so I don't mind that, and I do think it's a good score, and I think it works with the movie. And I guess, you know, the scene I was kind of looking forward to after Skyfall was just Bond walking into M's office, because M's office had been so set up. It's the same office, and all it is it's the chew-out scene. Oh, Bond, you went rogue, you did all this, you know, and now I gotta ground you. And, you know, right then and there, you want to talk shifting in your seat, I was like, it's going to be one of those movies now.
Which lunatic asylum did they get you out of?
Right. So then Moneypenny goes to the house. That's where you see the bulldog and the...
And the video from M. And yeah, we learn that M gave him the assignment.
Correct.
Yeah, we go to Bond's place for what, the second, third time ever?
Bond's got to live somewhere. I don't mind going in and seeing what that place is like. And yeah, they can make a gag on it, the furnishings and all that.
It's what you figure. He wouldn't be living large. He just uses it just to sleep.
I don't mind dipping into the window a little bit on Bond in that way. It's just, I mean, I think one of the problems that you have with serialized storytelling is eventually you're going to dip into soap opera-ish elements. It's just sort of unavoidable. I mean, even the best of the dramatic TV shows find themselves dipping into those things. You know, that's how soap operas keep running for years and years and years. They embrace all those cliches and do them and all that. But eventually, sometimes you're going to find yourself in those waters. Sometimes just dipping your toe in or getting, you know, your feet wet, are just swimming or drowning and trying to get out. This movie is going to rely on a lot of baggage to give Bond, to give him depth, to give him a backstory, to give him all of these elements, these layers. And it's one of those things that I think is going to split audiences. Some Bond fans are going to like all that. And there's me that just kind of, I don't need it. I just don't need it. That's one of my favorite Stevens lines. It's like, yeah, it was fine, but I didn't need it.
I didn't need it. That is classic Stevens. Since when is Moneypenny like traveling to Bond's house too? That's, you know, I thought that again, back to where we left everything with Skyfall. Q is in Q Branch. Moneypenny at the desk. M In the office. All right, let's go here. So it was a little off-putting for me to see both Q and Moneypenny still being field agents. I mean, didn't we already settle that, especially with Moneypenny? She does not belong in the field.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
It's a nice scene at the desk, too.
Well, that's what we're used to seeing Moneypenny behind the desk. He tosses his hat in the hat rack. He comes in, you know, plays with her a little bit. But, you know, this isn't the Bond of our yesterday. This is the Bond of today.
Bring tears to your eyes.
There's going to be a little switcheroo or sort of a little change up in there. But again, it's sort of the theme of the movie. Let's take Bond down to Q's lab. But guess what? You don't get to have all this. We go through all this long thing. I mean, I guess it's just a setup so he can take it.
Right.
The watch is a tradition in Bond. I think one of my favorite throwaway lines, I think, might have been in Die Another Day, where Q hands him a watch. He goes,
"Now, new watch. This will be your 20th, I believe."
And I kind of like that. New assignment, new watch. It just sort of fits. I think about in Moonraker when he got the one that shot out the little dart. So that's a nice tradition to kind of fit in.
At least they kept the watch tradition going.
What's the 21st century version of it? That's what I always ask myself on all these things.
Why not have the conversation right there? Why come to my house later and show me this file, you know?
Because he wants to show her the video. I asked myself that too, because you could have done it easily in that walk and talk, but he wanted to show her the video of M.
Gotcha.
And wanted that's got to be the reason, yep. You know? Because that gets her on his side immediately and everything else. You could have just cut to Bond's house and have her right at the door, too. And we would have gone along with it just fine. But this movie, that's shoe leather. That's good shoe leather. You kind of fill in the blanks of a couple of things. But this movie's got space. This is the longest Bond movie. It's not in any hurry because it has nothing to be in a hurry to get to.
Right. That part's very true.
You know, I hated this. I knew you were going to make me dislike the movie by the end of this podcast. I knew it was going to happen.
Well, we're just getting started.
I know. We're barely 15 minutes into the movie, and I'm already questioning myself.
On the contrary, I have satisfied myself that one of you is clearly guilty of embezzlement.
Now I'm settling in. It's like, all right, we're through all that, and I'm just kind of going with the movie. From here, we go to, what, the funeral scene?
And finds the Monica Bellucci, who should have been a Bond girl the whole time. I mean, if there's one woman on this earth that deserves to be a Bond girl.
What a waste of Monica Bellucci.
I know, one scene. I know.
I thought so, too. I mean, when she was announced in the cast, the first thing that clicked in my mind was Electra King from The World Is Not Enough. I thought, she's probably going to be the one behind everything. That would probably be the 21st century way to do Blofeld or to do the syndicate, is it wouldn't be a man behind it, it would be a woman. She would have men running it for her, but she would be the person behind it all. Her purpose was just really so Bond could kill a couple of guys, he could bet her, and she could give him the information of the meeting. She really doesn't have much other purpose outside of that, right? Which, okay, that might be fine enough. It's more than the opening girl, right?
It's a glorified version of that role from Casino Royale. And they had a relative unknown actress come in, beautiful. It just was such a waste of Monica Bellucci. She does nothing. She gives that information up ridiculously easy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Here's what I think they should have done is have another 10 minutes of her with Felix. That would have been awesome.
Well, well, well. Felix Leiter, you old fraud.
I miss Felix. I like Jeffrey Wright. I thought he was a great addition to Casino, underused in Quantum, and now he's just gone. And as a Bond fan, that's again another reason why I like Casino so much, nodding to Felix. That would have been lower on my checklist. But I like it if a Bond film can address Felix and make him useful. We could have used him in this movie, I think.
We really could have, actually.
Hey, man, they only had 2.5 hours, man. They can't do it all.
Well, we wouldn't want that, would we?
Now, when he's at the funeral, this is the after you see the movie, you can start looking at it this way. The whole scheme behind this movie is obviously we're going to learn that Christoph Waltz is going to be revealed as...
Allow me to introduce myself. I am Ernst Stavro Blofeld.
Welcome, James. Cuckoo.
As Blofeld. We'll just get this, we'll deal with this now. And that his whole scheme was...
Can't tell you how much I've been looking forward to this. All of us here together. A reunion.
he had a relationship with Bond in their past, and they shared a father figure.
You probably know that James here lost his parents when he was young. But did you know that it was my father who helped him through this difficult time?
Because this man adopted Bond when his parents were killed.
Asked me to treat him as a brother. My little brother.
And these two grew up together, and apparently this father favored James.
Over the course of 2 winters, he taught him to ski, and climb, and hunt. He soothed the wounds of the poor little blue-eyed orphan.
And he had such daddy issues over that particular thing, he had to kill daddy.
Yes, I did.
And then run off and fake his own death and then become the biggest international criminal ever.
This cuckoo made me realize my father's life had to end. In a way, he's responsible for the path I took. So thank you, cuckoo.
So he could get his final revenge on James. So from... And this has all been orchestrated by him behind the scenes. So everything in Casino Royale with Lashif, everything in Quantum with Mr. White, everything in Skyfall with Silva, he has been behind the strings behind all of this.
François Bauza died 20 years ago, James, in an avalanche alongside his father. The man you're talking to now, the man inside your head, is Ernst Stafford Blofeld.
For one sole purpose is to bring Bond to him so he could put him in a chair and have a conversation with him and basically have his psychiatric session of saying, I have daddy issues and I win because I'm killing you now.
Cuckoo.
Am I wrong?
Oh, you pretty much nailed it.
Okay. I don't like it.
You don't like it?
I don't need the daddy issues. It's just really kind of soap opera-y to me. It's kind of weak. And I don't need him to be Blofeld either, because that's the whole deal. Bond knows who he is. We don't in the audience. So for the next 2 hours, basically, or, you know, it's going to be drawing that out as long as possible for the ultimate reveal that Bond knew anyway. So this whole movie could have gotten rid of all of that fake mystery and that long drawn out by just addressing him at the funeral saying, look, brother, I know who you are. And I'm coming for you.
At what point in Bond's life does the avalanche happen? Is Bond already working with MI6?
No, I think it's when they're younger.
Oh, they're kids, aren't they? Isn't he?
Yeah, according to the picture that they find, I bet they're like in their teens or something.
Right, well, that's certainly the picture. But when does the incident when he fakes his own death?
I think it's not too far after the picture, because then Bond goes up into the boarding school after that and then gets picked up for MI6.
This is incredible. This kid, this teenager, sets up his foster brother, his adopted brother, by making him think he's dead so that just in case he becomes an international spy and assassin, that he can take him out some 25, 30 years later.
Cuckoo.
That's really what's going on here?
Yes, but it's called the future, so get used to it.
That's what a bunch of people sat around in a room and came up with. Four writers.
Wow, and I mean, you know, I mentioned earlier that Bond doesn't seem to have a whole lot of foresight about what his next move is going to be. You go back to Casino. What if Bond dies during the poison scene? I mean, it's over. He's been waiting for 15 years to tell him about his daddy issues, and he's dead. And I mean, there's so many chances Bond has had to actually die before that moment. That's weird.
Cuckoo.
That is just a weird setup for the climax of this fourth installment.
That's lame. Lame. Sorry.
And meanwhile,
this is the problem with what is called retconning. It's called you're making this decision after the fact. You're trying to insert this into the existing movie. It's like trying to make Deckard a replicant and inserting it into Blade Runner after the fact and reworking it that way. And first of all, it's not that great of an idea, but they were sold on it, and they just thought that it's this Marvel shared universe curse where, oh, it's like serialized television. It's all interconnected and all that.
Spectres are dedicated fraternity whose strength lies in the absolute integrity of its members.
I mean, the argument is Bond's never done it before. Okay, we tried it. We did it. Let's move on.
Cuckoo.
It sounds like the plot from Return of the Jedi, if you ask me. All of a sudden, he has a sister he doesn't know about. They're coming out of the woodworks about it.
I'm not a big fan of these villains that are now connected. It'd be like learning that Khan and Kirk. Oh, basically, you grew up together, and they shared a past. I don't need that. That doesn't enhance the dramatic, you know, experience for me. It kind of makes me roll my eyes and go, that's really lame. There used to be a term called fan fiction when I was growing up, and it's when people would write their own versions of, you know, the stories for their favorite characters of Bond and whatnot. And they used to always have those kind of elements where they always tried to tie everything in and make everything connected. We always had brothers or, you know, lost connections and family and whatnot, because in fan fiction, the worlds were always interconnected in that way. But it comes across like that here, and it's just not very strong.
Well, it's, you know, the question that you have to ask is, who is Blofeld for? I mean, because if you didn't grow up watching James Bond films on Sunday night movie or Monday night movie or whatever, you don't even know who Blofeld is, you know? Who is that big grand reveal actually for? Is it for us? And what is the percentage of people who have been with the series for 30, 40, 50 years? Does that really play for and go, wow, that is so wonderfully thought out and planned? I mean, what is the percentage of people that are like, that is for me, you know? Because if you haven't seen it, if you're 18 or 25, you know,
it's Star Trek Into Darkness syndrome all over again.
Yeah, it really reminds me of that.
Well, I don't necessarily take that as a throwback, but I agree that it's an unnecessary addition to the plot.
I actually like it, but not as the big reveal of everything that this 2.5-hour movie is leading to. You know, I mean, that reveal, I mean, if you've got to make it Blofeld, I don't think that's your climax, is it?
Yeah, I don't know. And again, when we get to the ending, I think there might have been some other ways and interesting ways to deal with it.
So, James, why did you come?
I came here to kill you.
But I'm going to take the Stevens quote. I didn't need it to be Blofeld. I've got Blofeld.
I am about to inaugurate a little war. In a matter of hours, when America and Russia have annihilated each other, we shall see a new power dominating the world.
I can go back and watch Thunderball.
2,000,003. Our expectations were considerably higher, number 11.
Or Diamonds Are Forever, or On Her Majesty's Secret Service. I've got the Blofeld assignments. What's next? We bring him back Hugo Drax? Is Max Zorin going to show up in the next movie? I don't need to reuse villains from the past. Who is the Blofeld of the 21st century? That's what these writers cannot come up with. All they can do is look to the past and rehash and rejigger and rework and put a glossy sheen, a professional-looking sheen all over it, and call it a Bond movie.
Well, speaking of professional glossy-looking sheens, the blown-out look at this movie did not work at all for me. These wonderful locations that they spent millions and millions and millions of dollars on, you couldn't even tell where you were. I don't know. Did the look of the film?
I wasn't a big fan of the bleached out look. I mean, I think the cinematography is good, but again, that's color timing at the end of the day. And I just think they washed out some potential production design and some color from the film. But that's what they want. That's the tone they wanted.
Yeah, they went for it for sure.
Yeah, that didn't bother me as much as it bothered you guys. And I thought there was some stunning cinematography.
There was some cool focus pulling and some nice lighting for sure. But when we got outside and it looked like there was 15 feet, and that's, you know, and then it was smogged in after that.
Going back to the information that Bond gets, he goes to the big quantum spectra meeting.
Spectre?
Right, and gets to sort of sneak in, and I guess as good as Bond is, they clocked him from the moment he came in. But okay, yeah, he had that little thing with the guards. So the way I always fill in these blanks is well, how did he know? It's like, well, there's got to be video surveillance everywhere. So I would imagine Blofeld clocked everybody that came to the meeting, so it would have been easy to suss that Bond was there.
Or maybe there's a tracking device in that ring, and they know that Bond's there or whatnot. So, okay, you got the big table scene, and we get the organization, and child slavery, right? Prostitution, something like that. They're evil, right? Because they do that.
Well, that's the most evil thing I can come up with.
And that's what I mean. It's like they had to sit down and go, okay, we got all these people around a table. What's the most evil, worst thing that they can be for and that they're doing? And we'll have them do that.
Sex slavery.
Yes, I thought I saw a specter at your shoulder.
That's it. Got it. All right.
Wait, let's make it one worse. Can we make it children?
Oh, it's your specter against mine, huh?
And then we get the introduction of Jinx. Hinks.
Who, Bautiste? Now, look, what are you going to do? They need a big henchman. They need some guy out there. He just came off of the Guardians of the Galaxy. It's a hot commodity right here.
There was a lot of potential between him as an actor, as a physical presence.
Correct.
You know, they're not going to suit this guy with a lot of dialogue.
As they shouldn't. He should be a silent assassin, as most of the good ones are.
They want him to be odd job Jaws. They want him to fit into that mold. That's fine. Now, let's think about this. He's employed by Mr. Blofeld, but, and this is again your refrigerator moment for the whole movie, every action set piece is about Hinks going after Bond. If he kills Bond, that means, like, think about the train scene. He has the big fight with Bond on the train. Well, Blofeld has a car going to meet that train to pick up James Bond. If Hinks kills him, Blofeld's plan is just blown. That means everything that he's been plotting all these years is just thrown out the window because Hinks did his job and killed Bond. So when we're in the moment, it's just always trying to kill Bond because we don't know Blofeld is really behind all this and has a car waiting for him. So we're in the moment just thinking it's another Bond action scene. But when you think about it, when you pull back the curtain, when you look at all of it, it makes no sense at all for Blofeld to have any of these things happen if he really wants to get Bond in the chair and have the monologue.
Well, we don't see this on screen, but Blofeld told Hinks, don't kill him. I just want to scare him.
There you go. There you go. There's your rewrite. And and basically the way he attacks James Bond, I believe it.
Oh, wow.
Come on. Because, okay, that is a beautiful location to put a car chase in. No doubt. Expensive looking cars.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
The streets are empty. And it's like, I bet you that was $1 million a night to shoot. I mean, I heard it was an expensive car chase, but God, it's dull. What happens in it? They go around some corners. They take a roof off a car.
Down the stairs was pretty cool.
There was like sparks and stuff.
Really, just at the end, you know, okay, the bits are the music channel.
No.
The flame channel and the ejector seat with the classic switches, you know, just because I guess Q is feeling retro.
Yeah, Q's retro. He's, you know, he's got one foot in the 21st century and one foot back in the 20th. Absolutely. I didn't have a problem with those switches at all.
No, and being a NASCAR fan, I loved when they were riding on the side of the wall. That was fantastic.
It's a gorgeous location. I mean, that's the thing. I felt like it really just wasn't all that exciting of a car chase. It was elegant. It was pretty to look at, but you know, there was real no bang up, you know, real threat. No guns came out. There was really no, it wasn't heightened all that much. It was like really pulled back. And again, in a movie, if I would have just seen one of the best Bond bits ever previous, I might have been okay. But this is the new bit. And again, it's just falling right in line with the others where it's like, God, you guys have not added anything. You didn't carry the torch further. You stood in place. Professionally done, classically done. I don't miss all that shaky cam from Quantum of Solace and that atrocious editing. Don't get me wrong. But at the end of the day, I just wasn't that excited by it. And that was the thing about this movie. A lot of it I just kind of thought was dull as I was watching it, kind of going through the motions. And ultimately, when the big reveal happened, that's when my mind traced back in the last hour and a half. And I just went, wait a second, that was all bullshit. It was just all just a waste of time to get to this. That means they didn't have anything for this movie. They were just stringing out ideas and calling it a movie. Four writers, though?
Shocking.
John Logan, who wrote Skyfall, writes a draft. And they start from there. But then they bring in Neil Purvis and Robert Wade, who have been on the franchise since World Is Not Enough, period. And they do a rewrite, and that's not enough. And this other guy, Jess Butterworth, comes in for the final polish. So I just felt like they might have been just too locked in to too many of the things they had already made decisions on. And, you know, like a Bond movie, once the green light is lit,
that train's rolling.
And it's expensive. Every day on Bond is no less than $1 million of a shooting day. I don't see, with the size of crews they have and the location permits they're going to need and the locations they want to go to. And let's face it, you don't stay in the cheap hotel if you're on the Bond crew. You're in the good hotel. I bet the increase of making Bond movies, it's there. The Bond tax is going to be there. Wherever you go, if you're, you know, a low-budget movie, you get one rate. If you're Bond, they're going to jack up their rates, and they're going to get top dollar because they know, A, Bond can afford it, and B, it's good for their business if Bond picks them. Now, I always thought Bond was in the position to say, look, you want to be with us, you'll give it at the rate we tell you, or you won't be part of Bond. But I don't know if that's happening or not.
Well, with the product placement that this movie has and the people that pay the money to have the product in the movie, it's really ridiculous. I heard a story on the radio where Nokia wanted to be a part of the Bond franchise. And they thought about it and they were like, well, you know, Bond is used to using the best stuff available, so I don't think we're going to use... Oh, no, it was a droid. It was a droid he was going
to
use.
They both competed.
Mm-hmm.
That was upward... up to $40 to $50 million was wow. part of the pool.
That's a huge chunk of money.
Mm-hmm. Heineken. I mean, we heard Craig complaining about shooting the Heineken commercials, right? He'd rather slit his wrist with glass than shoot another Heineken
commercial.
I'd rather
slit my wrist and drink a Heineken, to be honest with you.
Well, if you'll forgive me, I find that a little too scented for my palate. I prefer the Theotaki Aspera.
And, you know, that's the only hype I had for this movie. So I'm going into Safeway, and I see the big, huge placards of him holding the Heineken bottle. And it just put a bad taste in my mouth.
Bring tears to your eyes.
It comes with the territory. It goes back to Connery. They've always had to do it. It's just been part of the franchise, and it's a big way the franchise has paid for itself and promoted itself over the years.
I know it has to happen. It's an evil necessity, but... man, every time I get my groceries, it pisses me off a little bit more.
Hard to turn down that much money from Heineken, and they're going to put that much money into letting people know your movie's out.
And he really didn't drink that much Heineken in the movie. He still had his martini.
I don't remember the Heineken in the movie.
No, he drinks one.
Wasn't he laying in a bed or something, or he was laying down?
Was it in his apartment, or was it in the safe house?
It's not like Austin Powers, where it was obvious to me, so... And speaking of Austin Powers, I mean, didn't kind of Mike Myers retire Blofeld anyway? After that, really? I mean, we'll never do it that way again. But it just seemed like, I don't know. Again, I don't need him to be called Blofeld. Come up with the new Bond villain.
Seems terribly difficult. No, it isn't, is it?
Hinks reports back, okay, Bond is dead. Really, Blofeld should be fucking pissed. Fuck! How am I going to now confess my daddy issues to this guy? He's gone, right?
He doesn't believe it. He's like, no way. James isn't dead.
And it is nice when he parachutes down. I like that. I like Craig. He is the right man for the job. I just don't like the assignments they're sending him on.
Hey, wait a minute. You don't mean assignments they're sending him on. You mean the rogue missions that he undertakes.
Well put. Well put.
No doubt. Well, this is a new Bond for the new era, you know?
I can only throw up my hands and say, you're right. And this, the most successful Bond, it's not like these are unsuccessful movies. It's like in the Dalton, those are the lowest grossing films in the series. So they moved as far away from that. They knew it wasn't working. Something's working here because they're box officely successful. Did you guys like the meeting between Spectre, that you know, in shadow and the whispering and all that?
Sit down, number two.
The setup is cool. It's in a big Roman area, you know, big grand and all that. That's what I imagine the Illuminati would be, if there was such a thing. But I love the setup. I love the grandness of it. It seemed like something Bond would go through when he's getting chased through the parking lot and he's backing up.
It's so strange because in Quantum of Solace, he has such the upper hand when he goes to that opera scene. But here, he doesn't really. He's in the situation that just has to kind of flee it.
I expect him to look over to the right and see Tom Cruise with a mask or something.
Yeah, I guess Kubrick's ruined that forever.
Yeah,
right?
Thanks, Coob.
One of the things that I thought was interesting about this was how much it did remind me of the Mission Impossible Rogue Nation film that came out earlier this year. They have very similar plots about, you know, the takedown of the organization, and Cruise's character has to go rogue and enlist the help of other associates to pull off the mission. But in that film, I have to admit, the gag of Cruise hanging on the outside of the airplane is a great gag.
It's better than anything in this film.
I have to agree.
I do, too. That's the one thing I remember. It's like, You know, that is something that should be in a Bond movie.
Cruise gets it. He's of the school of the Bond movies. I mean, he grew up on them. He understands their impact. And he's gone. I mean, even the one in Mission, the last one, the Brad Bird one, outside that building, there is nothing on even. They don't even have a whiff of that in the new Bond movies.
Yeah. And it's really him. There's no CGI. I mean, there might be wires edited out or something, which is fine.
Wire removal is absolutely fair.
But man, he's on the side of that jet, taking off, holding on. It's awesome.
And I think the bike chase in there had more excitement than the car chase in this Bond movie. It's strange to see the other guys outdoing Bond, and Bond just taking a back seat and letting it happen.
Well, we wouldn't want that, would we?
Bond off to Austria to tie in the other movies so we can meet Mr. White again and get just another piece of information. Basically, the movie is the same movie, scene by scene by scene. Bond has to go somewhere, get a piece of information from somebody, so he can go somewhere else to get a different piece of information from somebody else, so he can go to this next place to get a piece of information to go to the next place to get to a piece of information to go to the next place. It's just the movie feels like it's on repeat for each little bubble.
But you get to revisit characters that have been in the movies of past, you know? I mean, that's something. It was kind of cool to see him kind of held up there in his little safe house kind of thing.
I did not mind the scene of two assassins and the respect of giving over the gun from one assassin to another. There's elements like that that I can draw from that I feel like are plausible, realistic, and that's the kind of Bond shadings I don't mind. Those are fine. Those are good. Those are character-orientated motivations that work for me.
The only thing that didn't work for me was he kind of looked like John Hurt from the Crystal Skull. That kind of threw me off a little bit.
And then, yeah, he gets the information about the daughter, and then Bond has to go find Madeline Swan, the daughter. And, of course, she has to be in one of the most remote and beautiful locations ever. It's stunning to take a look at where that facility is located on that mountain. I mean, that is what Bond does best, right? I mean, they should be showing us stuff like that, and that's what I like. I mean, I want those exotic locations and that, you know, those unique designs. I mean, I miss the old Ken Adam designs in the series, and even the Peter Lamont who took over. I mean, you would always, there would be something unique about that that would always just sort of make it Bond. And I did like the design of this facility. It had a very unique design to it that kind of, I thought, fit in. Whether or not it was practical or not, or purposeful, you know, it still worked in a Bond sense.
Yeah, let's send a bunch of loons up to this beautiful place and waste our time up there.
I guess, was there a landing strip with a bunch of airplanes and stuff, and that's how Bond got there, and he clocked the fact that in case I need an airplane later, it'll be there? Did I miss that scene? Was that on the cutting room floor, or did I blink? And
You have to ride the gondola to get there, right? So the airplanes actually and helicopters land in a different place, and you gondola up
to it. Okay, because boy, he really finds that airplane really fast when they kidnap her, and we ensue on our plane chase thing. But okay, whatever. It's
with
Bond.
That, you got to suspend disbelief.
You do. I mean, I I'm the kind of guy that, you know, if I'm in the room, it's like, how about we just have a shot of when Bond's entering or he walks past and he clocks an airfield and sees a couple of planes over there. Focus pull. He walks right in the building. Whatever. And you know what? You don't need those breadcrumbs. You don't need that kind of shoe leather. But in this movie, there's plenty of room for it. That's all.
A deceitful, perverse woman. A liar. A cheat. And I'd like some answers now.
Anyway, we're introduced to our new Bond girl.
My name is Dr. Madeline Swan.
What do you think? Madeline Swan, the new Bond 24 girl.
Well, she played it properly. I mean, you know, we didn't get just jumping into bed with Bond. We got a little cat and mouse action, you know, a little playing happen, which is good. I mean, you know, you need that. Especially in the opening scene where she's questioning him and he's like giving all the good, you know, kind of smart ass answers, you know.
Humor me.
Kind of feeling each other out.
Do you think her father would have trained her? I mean, we get that scene with the gun later on the train when she knows how to, like, what, take a bullet out. And
well, she did have that moment where she turns the needle back on the guy, right?
And there you go. They place it there. But she doesn't try and jump out or escape or really do anything. And maybe they're going too fast down the hill for that kind of behavior, too. But I guess I was just sort of underwhelmed by the whole sequence. I mean, here's Bond in the plane,
And I don't know, it really didn't do that much for me for a sequence. I was thinking like you were, John. Bond's really reckless in it. He could really kill her at any moment with any move with that plane.
Or himself, or, you know, I mean, it's just, the thing that just kept coming back to me is Bond is not thinking several moves ahead here. He's not saying, okay, I need to do this because then I can accomplish this, which will get me to that. He's just relying on his skill as a lucky person rather than his skill as a thinking person. And that didn't really work very well for me. I mean, it's kind of hard to put my finger on it, but maybe that's what they want, is it's just, wow, it's so amazing how lucky Bond is. I just always saw him a little differently.
He's differently in Casino Royale. Think about when he's chasing that guy after the construction yard sequence and the guy goes into the compound. The first thing Bond does is run and hop on the back of a van. And he's riding along and he can scout him. And then 2 seconds later, he's up on top of that van and uses it to jump over the wall. It's like he's always plotting. It's like all the moves he's making are going to advance him to his eventual goal.
Exactly.
So that Craig Bond is like, feels more like Bond to me in that movie, in all of the sequences he goes through, and he's just on his rookie mission. In many ways, he's getting worse as an agent as these movies go on.
I'm sorry. That lost hand nearly killed me.
Which surprises me as a Bond fan. And again, I want Bond to be the best guy in the room. I want him to win at the gambling games. I want him to have the knowledge and the information. I like that aspect of Bond. When in The Spy Who Loved Me, they challenge him on what the name of that fish was.
You recognize that variety, of course.
Of course. Pteroeus bonitans. Other fish avoid it. Those dorsal spines are laden with venom. Handsome but deadly.
I see you know your subject, Mr. Sterling.
One tries.
And I like that from Bond. He would have that encyclopedia knowledge to get him out of any type of situation. This one's going for the spectacle. And I guess, yes, when the plane goes through that barn, it's almost, you almost can hear the Monty Norman theme there, right? It's like it's almost trying to be that.
Do you really think that they really try to pay homage to every single Bond in this movie?
Well, let's ask somebody who might know. Hargrove, you got that list?
I'm not sure if they went into it trying to pay homage or if at this point we are just able to read it. I mean, yes, there's a big fight on a train. Is that really an homage, a throwback? I'm not 100% sure. Are the barrel rolls in the helicopters truly an homage or a throwback? I'm not so sure. I mean, it's obvious once we have the chance to look at it that we can put things where we want them to be. We have a funhouse scene. We have some very specific fashion choices. We do get shaken, not stirred. We do get Bond, James Bond. So there are a lot of things that I think were absolutely intentional. I need to do a little bit more thinking on it. You know, I mean, and you can look online and get the list and all of these things that are, oh, well, this has to be that. And I don't know. I'm not so sure that that was their intent. If it was, I just have to wonder why. Because we just did it in Skyfall. We just did it because, you know, and that was the 50th anniversary. And we just did it, you know, 4 movies ago in Die Another Day. So, I mean, is that just everyone that comes out is going to be a throwback now? I mean, you know, you could say that having the big lair in the crater is kind of the inverse of having the big lair in the volcano. But again, you know, that's kind of reaching, I think.
Big lair, I do expect that from Bond. I want to see the new big lair. I don't want to see. It's like when Ken Adam designed the big lair in The Spy Who Loved Me, he got the Moonraker assignment. He didn't design the same lair.
Right. Well, the underwater in Spy Who Loved Me is phenomenal.
But he was challenged not to repeat himself And he designed the volcano one from You Only Live Twice. But when you watch the Ken Adam Bond movies, you always see him stretching and reinventing and doing the new thing rather than just relying on old designs that he had done in the past. And again, I liked it in Die Another Day when Bond went down into Q's lab and I saw like the alligator from Octopussy. Those are fine. Those are fun. Those are nice touches. You know, you don't have to underline it and bold it and put exclamation points on it and draw attention to it. It's just there. And that's good. Unlike when, say, Bond is unpacking his suitcase on Imagine Secret Service and he keeps pulling out all the items from the other movies and they play the theme of that movie over each one. That's a little on the nose. Again, I don't need that for my Bond movies and I really don't want that. I don't want to think about a different Bond movie while I'm watching this one.
Well, there's your refrigerator moment. I mean, if you're constantly going, ooh, that's that, you're not in the movie you're supposed to be watching, right?
And that's where I found myself a lot of times when some of these things I would think, oh, that's a nod to so-and-so, and it took me out of it. And I had to consciously refocus myself to get back into the moment in this film. And I think, unfortunately, to some extent, they're going to suffer for that. And I guess my question is, are they going to have to make specific choices so that they're not invoking those other films? Like, for example, the fight on the helicopter. There's a specific shot when they're standing on the side of it, hanging off, that for me called back directly to that fight on the crane rig in Casino Royale. Was that intentional? Because it's a specific shot of their feet and they move and it's shot exactly like it is. Should they purposefully choose not to shoot that if it wasn't an intentional homage? It's a tough call, but it took me out of the moment. And all those little homage moments in this film really took me out of it. I really did not want them. And that kind of dovetails to my whole thing as well with how all these things were part of this big conspiracy that was all part of Spectre that we didn't know all along. And it just kept beating me over the head with all these things that just didn't work and I didn't need.
Let's talk about Q in the cable car. He's getting information for Bond off the ring and whatnot, but there's this man sitting across from him, right? Why doesn't he take out Q?
Right then. Yes, exactly.
What's he doing? What's he waiting for? Oh, wait, he's waiting for a bunch of passengers to come in so Q can make his escape?
And then they never pay it off. He escapes, they're gone, that's it, done.
The moment I saw those cable cars, I get the echoes, of course, of Moonraker.
Of course.
And I thought, wow, okay, over the snow, set piece. Q's going to fight a guy in there. He's going to get trapped, and he's going to have to get out of that. And Bond's now going to have to help him get out of that situation, or something would happen. Nothing. Boring.
Nope.
And really dumb on the villain's part. What are they waiting for?
And pointless. That added how long to this film? And I didn't need it. It didn't do anything.
Yeah. And that bothered me in the moment. I didn't have to go to the fridge for that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't have to go anywhere near the fridge for that. And then we start getting into, again, we can dive into this later, but I was telling Hargrove that one of my philosophies on this, one of my captions for this film also was the clip show.
Right. I thought we would get into that a little earlier, but yeah, lay this one out.
It's like one of those TV series that you watch, and sooner or later, inevitably, if it's on long enough, you're going to get to the clip show that you're going to try and show me where we've come from and wrap everything up nice and neat for me. And I felt like that from the opening title sequence, they were doing that. And it even took me out of the film in the opening title sequence. I'm like, I don't need to see Le Chiffre. I don't need to see these guys. I'm in this film now, but it just kept beating me over the head with it. And finally, man, when I saw those photos stuck on the wall, I was like, are you fucking kidding me? You printed out pictures and you taped them to the wall?
Blofeld, really? He either did it or had someone do it.
See, and the image of Blofeld walking around taping these things on the wall is an image that I actually thought about during the film. I was like, yeah, fuck you, Bond. Like, seriously?
I'm screwing with your brain now. You can't handle looking at a photo of Le Chiffre, can you?
And this picture of Le Chiffre? Oh, you're fucked.
What's that, Bond? I'm a little confused.
Remember M? I killed her.
Oh, and I need... Oh, okay. Here's the video of Vesper Lynd. Here's a picture of Vesper Lynd. Here's me talking about Vesper Lynd. It's all part of it. Hey, just mention her name. That's all I need. It's all connected? Great. I don't need you to connect the dots for me.
Well, then you're an idiot.
Don't you think Bond would have watched that videotape of Vesper, or has he just moved beyond
Well,
it?
Nobody had a VHS around. That's the problem with that. I thought about that, too.
He's not going to slip that in his pocket, or he's just, like, going to let that go.
And again, yeah, I'm like you. I don't need all the callbacks to the other stuff, because I just watched those movies before I came into this one. You wanted me to buy that Bond Blu-ray box set. I bought it, and guess what? I watched it. I have all of that information in my head. You don't need... It's like when the Rocky movies used to do the recap at the very beginning. I really don't need those anymore, because it's not 3 years later. My memory's sharp. I just watched that movie. I can go right on into the new one.
And viewers are smarter these days. We know that. We see that everywhere. The smart films take that into consideration. Don't need people to connect the dots for me. You put all this information out, you make all this stuff available. People are doing their homework. They're passionate about this series. They know who these people are. You mention them and that this is all tied together. Great. I get it. I don't need you to show me and then show me again and then remind me that you showed me and then print pictures out and remind me that you showed me again.
God, the clip show. It's like it was always either like around Christmas and like looking back at Christmas's past or maybe everybody but these two characters went out of town. And so, you know, they're sitting around going, oh, remember when?
And there's that thing for me, and this is totally for me. And again, I know this is maybe reaching a little bit. But the thing about a clip show for me also was, you're right, it's like around the holidays or summer or something like that. It's like, you know what? They were looking for an easy out. We just need to do something to fill some time here. It's the low-hanging fruit. And that's how I felt about this film. I was like, you know what? You're taking the easy way out here. You're trying to put it all together for me, and I don't need that, and it's not working.
I guess that's the ultimate problem with this, is they just didn't have it. And so they were just trying to cover up the whole movie, the fact that there was no real it there at the end of the day. But okay, Alpine Forest chase scene with an airplane in Austria. Does it make the Bond highlight clip reel? I mean, do you use that shot of when it busts out through the barn just so you can cut to something, Inspector?
It might be the most engaging sequence in the film. Back to what if there was some kind of tension going on between Q and those other two bad guys? What if Bond flies the plane through there? You know, if we can incorporate all of it kind of together.
At this point, I'd welcome it. I mean, just to kind of connect all the threads and tie it all together.
But again, my big beef, and I keep coming back to it, and I apologize for repeating myself, but it's Bond not looking 2-3 moves ahead is what really bugs me about all of it. So yes, just from the standpoint that they did this stunt with this plane, I guess that's what you're going to have to put on from Spectre in your best of James Bond stunts. But man, if you have to watch the whole sequence, I don't think you're coming home going, man, that was one of the best things I've ever seen.
No, and I think so much of this film, and I said this to Jansen, so much of this film is just checking boxes. You know, car chase, opening title sequence, song, check, 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 check. And there was just no, again, I go back to my theme. Is that all? Is that it?
I accept the assignment. I want to check those boxes. That's your job, making the new Bond movie. How do you embrace checking those boxes, though? I don't. All these critics over the years that just said, oh, Bond relies too much on formula, blah, blah, blah. They're wrong, okay? As a Bond fan, I embrace the familiar. I embrace the formulaic aspects of the series. It's been around for 50 years for a reason. Okay, now it's had many tenets and it's shifted through the decades, and I love and I'm fascinated by the differences and changes in Bond, and I like the one-offs. It's okay to play around with the series every now and then, but it just felt like they were just very uninspired in what they brought to the table for this one, or they were just in a rush, like you said, Hargrove, and they were just, all the first ideas made it into this movie, and they didn't really think about them or rake over them. They just said, well, shit, okay, we got it. Now we plugged that one, so what's going to be the next scene? Okay.
It goes back to something that you said years ago about Bond University or Bond Academy or however you put it, where you can't take the time after the last one wraps up and then take a year off and then start writing the new one. You're gonna fall into this trap. It's literally inevitable, I think, at this point. And when you take into consideration that you've got the Mission Impossible series, you've got the Bourne series, you even got Fast and Furious to take care of the car action scenes. I mean, where can you go with Bond except for really, truly curate it and make it something special? And you're not going to be able to shoehorn something in, throw $375 million at it, go on location and shoot it, and hope for the best. It's just not going to happen. You need to be planning, and you know, I guess here's my theme coming through. Like Bond, you need to be thinking 2-3 moves ahead. You can't just be going, all right, let's throw it out. You know, we've got that November 2015, we've got that November 2018 slot. We better just, you know, hope we get something watchable.
Well, and I think to go along with what you guys are saying too, you're right, Jay. Having those familiar pieces as part of the history of it, yeah, that's great. But what it felt like to me was just soulless. There wasn't any real heart in it. We were hitting the right, we were checking the right boxes, but that's all that it felt like, was just checking boxes.
And I felt like you were checking them for the wrong reasons, or the reasonings behind them I just thought were ill-conceived.
Yeah, and it's like he blows that one gas main at the end, and it blows, and then the whole thing blows up, and it's like, okay, enemy base destroyed, check. And that's, you know, that's, and at that point, it was like, I actually said out loud, is that all? And then it cuts to, like, a picture of Craig going, all right, that's not all. I was like, oh, they had the same idea that I did. Like, they needed to tell me that, oh, this isn't everything. Okay, all right.
Yeah, I think everybody in the theater was going, oh, please, can it be?
Right. Oh, wait, it's not all? Oh, okay.
Damn.
Well, back in the snow in Austria, you make a great point here, John. It would, you know, Bond, why doesn't he check Hinks? Wouldn't it have been great for a man with a license to kill just to execute this big assassin now he's had to deal with twice? Take him out of the picture? I mean, we don't... But no, just... Walk, get out of there with Madeline as quick as you can. Don't worry, he'll be back. That kind of thing. If Bond, it seemed like an older Bond would have seen that guy go through the window and went, you know what? This is not my first encounter with guy. This is the second. I'm going to put him down.
Look at Spy Who Loved Me into Moonraker. You know, I mean, basically what you have with Oddjaws is they're trying to create this sort of character that can't be killed, right?
I guess I just miss Roger Moore Bond with the car with the dove pen guy in it, and Roger Moore just kicks it right off the cliff. I'm done with you.
If you look back, Odd Job and Jaws, well, Jaws even makes it through two full movies, you know, before we finally get rid of him. So I can't even make this point. It's just so stupid that he doesn't kill him.
I said you're a bloody idiot.
Well, I mean, okay, so we got to move on. And then they got to go to Q's room. And, you know, then we're on to L'American, right? I mean, that's kind of, we got our information out of that scene. Yeah, the Q scene was underwhelming. There could have been a bit there, something. I would have liked to even see Q have to use his brains rather than luck to get out of that situation.
Or how about, since we've already talked about Bond only has the watch as his gadget, what if Q busts out a really nice gadget that he's been saving for himself?
A subtle one, you know? That would have been great.
I mean, if we're going to have to put him in the field, which is weird that he's there in the first place, okay, he can't do that remotely, okay, but whatever. You know, just anything. Because, I mean, okay, you've got him there, but you wasted him.
And there's just all this red tape with, oh, we're shutting down MI6, and, you know, you're all done. And it's like, it's just all felt tired. And she's like, here we go again. You know, MI6 is in trouble, and blah, blah, blah. The first thing that popped into my mind, of course, it's like, well, of course that guy's a traitor, a double agent, and this is all
Of course, our guy Blofeld is behind all this because he's been behind it since, we're going to find out later, Casino Royale. So I don't even know what the real threat is there, if there is really one there at all. But okay, so we go to the L'American and we get the hotel room scene, and I guess ultimately Bond finding the secret room, right? I mean, that's the whole point of all this.
And I think something that Hargrove said earlier really was one of my main issues with this. I don't like it when things happen by chance. It diminishes the character for me. He should be able to hunt down and find this room without the mouse going through the wall. Like, that's what showed him. You know, find it. You're James Bond.
What we're seeing is the recurring theme of tell, don't show. Tell, don't show. Just over and over and over. And you hit on it a little earlier. We are going to this exotic locale so we can get one piece of information, so that we can go to another exotic locale to get one more piece of information. So the whole buildup of, is it a person they're looking for, this L'American? You know, is it a, you know, what is it? No, it's a hotel. Ah, got it. And so now we're here just to find, you know, the coordinates.
And that's not an uncommon trait. I mean, I'm thinking Moonraker does that exact same kind of thing. But just somehow, I thought it did it a little bit more excitingly in that movie compared to this one. And I know that movie takes a lot of blows and takes a lot of heat. But in comparison, I'm just thinking, in comparison, it's looking really good to the fakery dumbness of some of these later entries.
Well, and I think this is a really interesting experiment and an interesting perspective on how things can be part of the formula, but just still not work. Be so formulaic that they just fall flat.
And hey, they tried it. It just didn't work for me. There are 4- and 5-star reviews of this film that think it's one of the 3 best Bond films in the entire series. That's just what this film has done out there. I mean, the audience is mixed on this one.
Well, that's a good thing. I'm glad a lot of people like it, seriously. You know, I love Craig. I think he's fantastic. And even, you know, all I've said about him kind of regressing a bit as Bond, he's still really good at it.
He's the man for the job. I like him, too. He makes all the lesser Bond movies that I don't like watchable because of what he brings to it. I just wish they were giving him better movies to be in. I think he's suffering somewhat of the same fate that Dalton did and Brosnan did. And late Roger Moore, for sure.
We want better assignments for him, and he's not getting them.
And so really, this is all to me like, okay, we got to have a train sequence now. So let's get him on a train. Let's get him in the white tux, okay? Let's do a dinner scene again, you know? I mean, again, that we did the James Bond train scene with the woman in Casino Royale, I thought, you know? I didn't think this scene was nearly as well written or as well performed or had the same tension or really much of anything. It was just like a strange echo and it was just here because it was just waiting. So, oh, Hinks can show up just out of nowhere, right? How does he know where they are? Well, okay, I can spin that, but it's just, isn't it convenient that he's just there? Right there, right on cue. It's almost like on the right line he waited. He's like hiding. It's like, no, I can't go in on that line. No, can't go in on that one.
I'll drink to that.
Wait for it. Wait for it.
I don't even want to hear the spin. I just was like, he's there, really? Fuck.
The spin is ultimate. If Blofeld has tapped into communications, has tapped into MI6, then he's going to know whatever they know. But hey, Jaws shows up on the train, and the guy from Russia with Love shows up on the train. We go with it, right? It's a Bond movie. It's a fight scene. I was underwhelmed by the fight. It was a train fight scene, but it didn't really do much to up the ante on the bit. Now, maybe if they were on top of the train fighting on a moving train, oh, wait, we did that in Skyfall. Well, that was a better bit. I just felt like it was just sort of safe and underwhelming. And I don't know, she's a terrible shot, I guess, for someone that knows. But she walks into the room and he could just, a big guy can just hide behind whatever he hid behind. And I don't know, it just seemed like a very clumsy
sequence. That seemed clumsy, but I will say I liked about that scene that she saves Bond. I will say I like that about her, and I thought that that made her a stronger character and added to what we were talking about earlier about her.
Yeah, I agree. You got to give her something.
And I like that they did that for her, and again, I like the way that in particular played. I like that she's a strong character like that, but the clumsy way it was handled in that scene, like, ooh, where's huge Dave Bautista hiding behind this tube of something? Yeah, you know, come on. That just didn't work for me either, because she is a good shot. You know she's trained. We've seen that already. You know, she's not a stormtrooper. She's not going to miss that shot from 10 feet away.
And he's just exposed of real quick. You're done. And I guess, considering how he was being used in the movie, that's probably the best solution. Let's be done with him. Because you don't have any ideas for something for him to do that's interesting and cool and new. You just want to run him through the paces of other stuff that's just ultimately not going to make the highlight reel.
Yeah, and that's the one line they gave him? Shit. That's the one line? Really? Okay.
Did he get a big laugh in your auditorium?
It was met with dead silence.
Yeah, me too.
So they're on this train, and they're let off in the middle of nowhere, for one. And then there's a car waiting for him, right?
Well, no, the car's not waiting for him. The car had to drive through that desert. And they were sitting there for a while. They probably had an Avion, you know, chilling.
But the car knew they were there.
Clearly.
How, I have no idea.
What does Bond say when they arrive?
This might be a long wait.
You're telling me, brother.
Wow.
Like 2 hours fitting. And 28 minutes.
I'm not going to say I was checking my watch, but...
That's the review of the movie, man, right there. But if you're watching this movie, you just think Bond finally beat the henchman because you don't know what's waiting for Bond. You don't know the ultimate endgame is waiting for Bond. And again, when that suddenly occurred to me, when Bond was sitting in that chair, that this was Blofeld's endgame, I thought, this is a mess. He's been playing this for all these movies, and yet Bond's just been luckily staying alive so he could get to this moment. That's when I realized this whole retconning is garbage.
Right.
It's just, you know, if you would have written Casino Royale and you knew you were going to do this from day one, you would have done it better, and you would have integrated it better into everything. Oh, but that's not what happened here. And boy,
no.
Do the seams show.
Yeah, absolutely. And
what you said, too, about her... Here's one thing that I really did not like. Okay, Bond strapped to the chair. I'm led to believe that he's electronically bolted in, right? I mean, not just straps, but they're electronically... Because when he blows up the console, suddenly they just spring open. No, Mythbusters the shit out of that. That's not what happened. If you blow up the console, it's not going to send the release signal to the chair to send those to open up. It's just gonna, like, dead, no signal, they stay locked. So it's an incredibly lucky moment for Bond. So my take is, why not keep him strapped, and he needs her to get him out. She has to get him out of the strapped chair, where he's fucked without her. So that's twice now. Without her, at least she has a reason to be in that scene. I mean, okay, she's there to get the watch off and to set off the explosion, but when it sprang open... I had a problem with that, and I shouldn't in a Bond movie, because we give Bond a lot. But that was just too damn lucky and stupid. That was as dumb as how Silva got out of the jail cell in Skyfall, because they had to do an electronic lock on that, even though MI6 had been hacked and infiltrated earlier in the movie. A fucking padlock, and he's going nowhere.
Yeah, I hated that too.
$3.99 at Home Depot, and fucking Silva's still in the cell right now.
On sale, 2 for $5.
Yeah, I hated this more, though, man. When that console goes and those locks sprang open, I thought, you've got to be kidding me. You've got to be kidding me. And let me get this straight. I want to make sure I understand this. You're a villain mastermind. You've been planning this for years. And you don't think, hey, you know what? I should probably take that watch. It's James Bond. No. No,
no kidding.
Sometimes a watch is just a watch.
No.
It's not, though. Silva would know. Silva was an agent. He had his own fair share of those watches, so they would have known. Always take James Bond's watch.
We're not going to frisk him. We're not going to take anything off him. We're just going to lock him up. And then we're going to put his hands conveniently right next to each other and then we're going to like spring things open. Oh, man, it was just one after another. It was just, oh, so bad. And when those locks opened up, it pissed me off. It really did. That's what pissed me off.
I'd rather have the watch on a table, like with all his belongings, and she has to go get it.
Yes.
And she has to set it off and do everything because he can't because he's strapped to the chair. Now there's a reason for her to be in the room. And again, they do use her. They just, the way that they chose to do it, I thought was weak. Everything about it is weak. And also, when he's getting drilled, doesn't he drill into the spot that's supposed to take off his memory? Didn't that happen?
Thank
Did
you.
Bond just get lucky again?
Okay, yeah, we got to get into that because, man, that was another thing that really pissed me off. Like, okay, you're saying that this is going to, like, rob him of his balance and his vision and he's going to hallucinate and all this other stuff. Like, when does that happen? Oh, not after this particular drilling. Oh, after the... Oh, wait, no, he's not going to remember her. Oh, but he remembers her because, wait, he was pressing on the watch. Did the watch help? Wait, no, the watch is a bomb. So how does this not work on Bond?
It's because she is so beautiful. How could you forget her?
I'm going to drill on him, but it's not going to work. Just somehow. What? So this mastermind villain who's been planning this for years, yeah, your shit doesn't work. And you're not going to take his stuff. That whole scene just really pissed me off.
Learned nothing from Lashif. He says it best in that movie. All these people with their elaborate torture devices when it's just really so simple. They didn't top that scene. And that scene didn't need gadgets. It didn't need anything. It was the most primal, the most brutal, the most realistic, the most emotional. Probably the best Bond torture scene in the whole saga. Yes, it's great to see him strapped to the Goldfinger laser and all that, but I mean, come on.
Just another passing face on your way to the grave.
So, what is it? Oberhauser, Blofeld's big scheme, right? What do you think?
He had a scheme? What was his scheme? What was his plan?
Information.
Information is all.
I guess he was going to uselessly and pointlessly drill on Bond. That was his scheme.
I mean, they hired a wonderful actor in Christoph Waltz, but God, they really underwrote his role. I mean, they didn't even write him a really good monologue. I mean, I would have hired QT to do a quick pass on this script just to give him something to chew on as an actor. I just felt like his skills were not utilized at all.
Yeah, agreed.
Remember that time when we were brothers?
Was there a cat in the room when they were strapping him to the chair? There was, wasn't there? That cat died in the fireball, didn't it? Son of a bitch.
Wow, you're right. I forgot about that cat. You're right. What happened to the cat?
God damn it.
No, that cat survived. Come on.
Yeah, it's a hairless cat now.
Oh, which brings us right back to Mike Myers, right?
So we're going to get the big escape scene, essentially. Now, from what I understand, they did go out to a desert and really blow up a bunch of stuff to create a big explosion. I read that somewhere.
Wow, that wasn't CGI? Amazing.
This is definitely going to be a big Bond moment.
We are hoping we're going to reach the Guinness Book of World Records as the biggest explosion ever in cinematic history.
We've got 8,140 litres of kerosene.
24 charges, each of which is a kilogram of high explosive.
Each explosion has a tiny microcomputer inside it, so it's really safe and really reliable.
4 hours out now from doing the explosion.
The adrenaline's starting to flow. We're getting to that point where the button is going to get pushed.
Three, two, one. Action!
And cut! Cannon!
All one shot. Come up the stairs. Line of dialogue. Largest explosion in the history of movies. Exit frame. Cut.
I think what surprises me most about this particular stunt is the Bond crew had all the best intentions. They went out to make a Guinness Book of World Records stunt. They wanted to blow up a bigger compound than anyone else had blown up before and put it on film. I love that ambition. I think that's great. It's interesting, though, because of Sam Mendes's
sort of, I guess, one-take mentality is the way he chose his film grammar to cover it. It's interesting to me that in a widescreen frame, 235, that he would put two people in front of the explosions, basically taking up 33-40% of the real estate on the screen for this, you know, world record explosion. It would have been very easy to either push in and move beyond the actors and have a full sort of proscenium view of the explosion. If you're going to hold it in one, you could have craned up. I mean, maybe for the world record explosion, you could cover it and shoot it from some different perspectives just to give that kind of impact. But for this film, I understand they wanted to keep that sort of film grammar going where they just step up in the frame and it goes off. But something about the digital enhancements in it, when I saw it on the big screen, when I should have been most impacted by it, I wasn't. And I had to ask myself, okay, as a filmmaker and as just as a student of this type of work, what was it that pulled me out? Was it the digital grading? And I think I lean a lot on that. More and more films that use that type of, you know, final digital grading, color correction, can put a digital sort of look over something that looked realistic originally. And I don't know what other kind of enhancements were made into that shot to give it more of a, you know, other stuff flying around in the debris and everything else. But just something didn't quite click right when I was watching it. But, you know, looking at the behind the scenes making of, it's obviously impressive. Why wouldn't it be impressive? They made a world record out of it. But something about the way they chose to shoot it and put it on film ultimately was underwhelming for me, and that's what surprised me. I mean, it's that should have been the thing that pulled me out and went, okay, that's what it's all about. That's what I've been missing in this film. But even that just sort of went by, and I went, okay, clock check, but why am I not getting that sort of visceral Bond feeling out of it? And again, you know, it could just be me. Other people could be, you know, clapping and cheering and proclaiming that the greatest shot in Bond history, but I'm just not one of them.
I have nothing to add to that. The scene was very underwhelming, and, you know, it happened way too fast. I did like a couple of things that happened leading into that. I liked Bond getting the guns from the guys that he took down and using those, and then have, you know, I thought that they thought it out a little bit by having him need to get new guns and things like that. It's just such an uneven experience to go through this and be like, okay, I like this. Okay, I hate this. Okay, I like this. Okay, I hate this. And especially for 2.5 hours to be going through that, it's relentless.
When was the last time you had that experience with a Bond movie? Yeah. Exactly.
Do Bond and Swan have to be in the shot that it explodes? I don't think they do. Do they?
I mean, I don't know. I go back to Mad Max Fury Road. When I saw that movie, I didn't realize how much fakery was in it. I was being fooled. It was digital magic. But when I went back and watched the effects reel on that and realized that so many of those craters were just placed around real vehicles and scenes, digital magic can happen. You can fool me, and you can integrate it all beautifully, and then you can't. And when you can't, it takes me out of the moment, and I don't like that.
Empty fridge.
So, okay, Bond / Ethan Hunt now has to assemble the team. So let's get him in, let's get Moneypenny, and let's get Q. The team's all here, right? And we got Madeline. No, we don't. She could actually be useful. This is the time where she decides, okay, nah, my skills, my knowledge, and all of this I've been through, nah, what, nothing more of it. I'm out of here.
Yeah, if you're going to choose this, I'm out.
I'm out.
And you know why she decides to do that, right?
Kidnapped, because fucking seriously.
Again.
Really? You know what we've never seen before? A kidnapping.
When he's looking at her walking down that street, everyone in the audience knew she was going to get kidnapped. We all just saw that shot of her back. That was the first thing that popped into all of our minds. Had to be. Come on.
Is she going?
You knew.
Is she going to get kidnapped?
That's bait. It's like bait. Just walking out there. It's just a matter of when it would happen. You know.
Right. Yeah, weak, weak, weak.
Yeah, because then you have to think about Bond thinking, nah, she won't get kidnapped. She'll be fine. She'll be fine.
I actually had the thought that she was on the other side, that she had been playing Bond the whole time. I had that thought for just a second, and then I was like, nah, she's going to get kidnapped.
I had that same thought, I have to admit.
We've seen this series mimic The Dark Knight, so you know it would not have surprised me if they would have pulled something like that out. You know what we've never seen? A building collapsing on itself and Bond just barely making it out of it.
Let's make that the third act of Spectre.
Yeah, because we did it so well in the first act.
C being revealed as working for Blofeld. Were you surprised? Not really. I wasn't.
We have not really talked much about that aspect of this movie. We keep jumping over the cutbacks to him. We haven't really talked about what Blofeld's other end game is, other than, you know, being
able... Yeah, I mean, they have their little vote, and they don't get all the votes, so of course they have to cause that terrorist attack in South Africa, so now they'll get on board, and now C's in control, and M, you're out, and MI6 is out, and it's all like blah-de-blah, blah-blah. I'm in a James Bond movie. All this shit's going to get fixed by the next installment anyway, so this is all just biding time. It's just, it's nothing.
And there's so many of the Fenster roles from Usual Suspects in there. You might as well just talk mumbled, because it didn't matter. It didn't matter what C said and that whole thing. It was just pointless. And then he dies.
And then, yeah, Bond goes through his little memory lane and through the old MI6 building and gets to confront him behind the glass. And now you got 3 minutes to go save her life again. You know, the time clock and all that. But, okay, yeah, okay, he has to run up and get her, and they escape. And then the next thing I know, you know, they're on a boat. They go down through the bottom bowels of MI6, and suddenly they're on a boat. And ultimately, the boat on the water and Bond shooting the helicopter was underwhelming. It's just kind of a dull sequence. It's like the ending of Die Hard 3 when he has to shoot the helicopter out of the air. It's just not that exciting, honestly. And the helicopter crashes, and then ultimately, all right, let's just cut right to it. Bond standing over Blofeld with a gun, and he's got his two lives on either side of him. The M and Madeline Swan, two M's. Where is he going to go?
So, James, why did you come?
I came here to kill you.
Honestly, there's a side of me that likes the fact that Bond and the villain lives. Because in most Bond movies, you know, the villain's always got to die, and that's always very predictable and all that. So it's interesting to me in today's world that, okay, he's captured.
And I came here to kill you.
In this movie, I wanted Bond to put a bullet right through his brain. I wanted the man with the license to kill to shoot him cold, and Bond would have been back. And I think if I could have just gotten a moment like that. Because really, if you want to play the game of chess, there's no reason to keep this man alive. Take him out. Because we already know he's got people everywhere. This guy is not going to make it down the street to the lockup before he escapes. Okay? Think about it. There's just no way he doesn't have people planted everywhere. He's not going to get to the jail cell. 10 minutes after this movie is over with, he has escaped. Bond should know that, and he should put a bullet in his brain.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
Connery would have done it.
Bond. James Bond.
Dalton would have done it.
Bond. James Bond.
Brosnan would have done it.
Name's Bond. James Bond.
Hell, even Roger Moore would have kicked the car over.
My name is Bond. James Bond.
In taking care of business, Craig walks away.
Let's go home.
And says, I don't want to be Bond anymore. I want to go be with Madeline Swan.
Not only walks away, throws his gun into the Thames.
So you're asking me, I've been twitching in my seat this whole time, and that's the ending they give me. I'm just, what comes after underwhelmed?
Well, they did set that up. You have the sequence earlier with Moneypenny and her boyfriend, and she says, and she plants the seed. It's called having a life. You should look into it. And, you know, through everything that he's been through, you know, he just wants to love.
And that's the soap opera aspect of this just drawn out serialized storytelling.
I think they got away with something in Skyfall, where if they'd have just left it alone, then it'd have been fine. But I just, in some ways now, I think Skyfall is even a less of a movie because of this one.
Yeah, totally agree.
It's falling in my expectation there, just because of they're crumbling it with what they're trying to add on to it.
So does this movie change anyone's opinion of Craig as Bond?
No.
I'm in. I'm all in for Craig. Like I said, I want the next installment to just give me a gun barrel, iris off on a brand new exotic something location, up the ante of your gags and your bits, give me a great theme song and title sequence. You know, I'm home free. You know, I want Craig on assignment. I've been ready for him to go on assignment since Casino Royale. And he was ready at the end of that movie. That's the thing. He was just so primed.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
Again, these films are very financially successful. If these were failures, the Bond producers would be correcting course. They would be doing something different. But what I worry about is, you know, there's all this talk now about replacing Craig, the next Bond, and all this. Even though I did not like the last couple of entries as much as others, there is absolutely zero reason for the Bond producers to get rid of Craig. He is the most successful Bond financially for the franchise. He is well-liked. Even for the people that don't like these movies, we all like Craig. I mean, that's usually the agreement. And it was the same thing with Brosnan. We went through those assignments with him, and it's like, God, you know, the first 45 minutes of Die Another Day is okay. Then they just all fall apart. And you feel bad for Brosnan because he came ready to play. Because you mentioned something, and I've always talked about this in Brosnan's performance. I always see him thinking as Bond, always. He is in character, and he is thinking, even if it's a look or a glance. And I loved that.
Yeah. Just looking at what can I do with that barrel, you know, just something as simple as that.
That comes down to direction and tone and take and what someone wants to do with Bond. And obviously Mendez wanted to bend and twist Bond and not do what others are doing, the anti-Casino Royale approach.
Or was it Craig? I mean, was it under Craig's vision of the character that he would hang it up, that he wouldn't use the license to kill at the end? He would throw the gun into the river. And finally, Bond finds love.
Is that satisfying for Bond fans? Let me just ask the room. Did anyone like that? If you did, it's fine. I can be wrong on this.
This is a new Bond. The Daniel Craig era is looking for love. He is not the James Bond of old, where he just bangs anything he sees and goes on. He's looking for this now.
See, I thought Bond learned that lesson with Vesper Lynn. I thought he put all that away after that first movie. He learned that, okay, I tried that. I got burned. That's not for me. I'm this guy. I'm really good at being this guy. I'm not going back to that other.
That's the way we thought it would have gone, but they keep instilling that this Bond has to find love somewhere.
They're retconning. They keep changing their mind late in the game.
Do I look like I give a damn?
Going back to what you said about the Bond Academy, I'm incredibly vexed that after the billion-dollar success of Skyfall, they could not spend $1 million and hire 20 writers, pay them 50 grand each, to turn in a Bond treatment. And I'm just talking about a story treatment. You don't even have to have a script with dialogue and whatnot, but 20 Bond stories that would probably give you about 40 to 50 bits, gags, spread out through all of these treatments. There has got to be 3 movies inside that experiment that you could cobble together through all of those ideas. I would also be holding title contests, $10,000 for the best entries, and I would lay out what all the next titles are and start working that out too. So at least if you're going to be the serialized Bond, you can really plot these things out in advance and at least get back to some of those other little things that you're not doing anymore that might be appealing, like James Bond will return in Risiko.
There's nowhere to go, the Risiko. There's nowhere to go, the Risiko. Your eyes on me. Your eyes on me.
I know they're setting up for a sequel. Of course they're going to not give an end game to him because they want him for a sequel.
If Mr. White had people on M's staff
Well, guess what? That's where they're going to set up the next movie, is him escaping, and that's going to be it. Just like a Quantum of Solace with the car chase at the beginning. You know, they're going to set that up so he's gone again.
And again, it just makes Bond look stupid and weak. It just makes the whole organization look... Because they got to know that they don't deserve the confidence they have that they could handle this guy.
Well, let's see. Their base has been blown up.
I mean, they basically almost got away with all of C's shenanigans. You know, they just barely caught that in time. I just think, man, clean slate this guy. Get him done. And then we'll start going after the other members of the organization. We got the ring. We know who they all are. So we really... Keeping him alive is more unuseful than useful.
You don't want him for a sequel?
No.
Really? You think that this Blofeld should have been just one off and done?
I don't want Blofeld back. I don't want Hugo Drax back. I don't want Max Zorn back. You know, I don't want anyone back.
Well, there are some things that just aren't done, such as drinking Dom Perignon 53 above a temperature of 38 degrees Fahrenheit.
No matter where they take him, they could take him to the deepest sort of basement of MI6. Blofeld has somebody connected on the staff that's going to get him out of that. And MI6 should know this.
Yeah, and so should Bond. I agree with you, Jay. When you said that earlier, I was in total agreement. He should cap him right there because he knows he's going to get loose.
It would have just been a Bond moment that I could have said, well, finally, Bond is back since Casino Royale. And they don't want to do this. I mean, obviously, they want the other thing, and I'm just reacting to it as a Bond fan. But I would just ask other Bond fans, had they seen Bond do that in that moment, would they have really disliked it?
Well, it wouldn't have gone with accordance to the rest of the movie. I mean, that's just not who he is.
I came here to kill you.
And you're right. They want to bring him back. That's the problem. They do. I bet they just want to do Spectre 2 for the next one. Oh, he'll be back again. And here's my problem, why I don't want to bring him back. They don't know what to do with him. If they had an idea of what to do with him, they'd have done it in this film. They have no plot. They have no gag. They have no purpose. No raison spectra for Blofeld other than to relate him to James Bond in a past, in a psychological way. And again, I just find that so weak. From a storytelling device. So, you know, I'm perfectly okay in being in the minority on this Bond opinion out there. I get it. You know, that's fine. I've talked to some other people. They like the fact he's Blofeld. They like the fact that there's a past between the two of them. They don't have any of the problems with the movie that I do. So, hey, this one's on me. I get it. I'm just reacting to what I saw. And I think some of the things that we pointed out, I think you are going to have your refrigerator moment with this movie, because you can't escape the inept writing and the plotting that occurred in this. You can get lost in the pretty cinematography and the fight scenes and the locations and everything that a Bond movie is for escapism. But I think even the Bond movies that even get critically pounded and even get sort of derided by other fans in the series, I think they've got tighter plotting. I think they got better connecting the dots and things sort of play out better than what I'm seeing on display here.
Geez, you know, when I walked out of the theater of this movie, I was thinking, you know, it's not bad. I didn't think I wasted my money with it. I mean, I saw all the plot holes. I was like, okay, Bong threw away his gun at the end. He wouldn't have done that. But I wasn't that angry with the movie. You guys ruined this fucking movie for me. I mean, holy shit, I don't even like it anymore. That's why I haven't said a fucking thing in the last hour and a half. I'm sitting back thinking, yeah, you're right. I would like to try to argue the points and say, yeah, it wasn't that bad, but fuck, I can't argue them.
One thing that was in the original script that I want to reveal here and talk about real quick, and we can get your thoughts on it, Mike, is the original endgame for the movie was Bond would have his gun crouching over, you know, Oberhauser, that's what he'd be known as by this point in the movie. And Bond would be looking down at him, and Bond's final end game is he doesn't kill him, but he tells him that, in fact, you were adopted all along, and your true name is Ernest Blofeld. And then Bond walks away. Now, that was the original ending. So that would have been the Blofeld reveal. That would have been, oh, your whole scheme and your daddy issues, you were adopted all along, blah, blah, blah. And that's how Bond trumps him at the end. That was what they went into production with, and that did change. And I think,
You know, that was when the Sony leak happened last year and the script got leaked, there were a lot of notes that got leaked, and they were specifically about the third act, and I wonder if that was part of that as well.
Oh, that's too bad. I kind of like that, actually.
Okay, that's interesting.
Or at least better than this, maybe. But I'd have to digest that for a little bit, because it might be just a knee-jerk reaction because I didn't like this movie.
Because it's the new thing besides the thing you didn't like. Totally.
Well, maybe that would have saved it. You know.
I still think if Bond could have just put a bullet in his brain, we would have had a real shocking ending. And, you know, maybe him not going away with Madeline Swann, maybe that would have been the ending. That would have been different, since we're doing something different with Bond also. But no, not to be. I get it. That's fine. You know, I didn't need Bond to go off with Camille at the end of Quantum of Solace. And, well, he didn't go off with M at the end of Skyfall because she was dead. There was no Bond girl for Bond to go off with at the end of Skyfall. So I guess they had to give him a girl, because no girl can survive these movies with Bond, right? Vesper's gone. You know, forget about Get In. She's gone.
You know, it's a whole PC thing that's just taken over. Motion pictures, everything that we're surrounded with. It's really, that's probably why the ending of this movie changed. Just they want him to go with a more pleasing scenario that everybody can get with, instead of just, you know, him blowing them away and be done with it.
And if he's Bond and he had her and she had him, I think he can blowfell away and she still wants to be with him. I bet, you know, Bond is still an allure enough. It's like, okay, even though you killed that guy and even though you're this, I still want you because you're Bond.
And meanwhile,
I like the fact that there's interesting parallels with her father and Bond being an assassin, her father being an assassin, all that. But, and I want to say that, you know, they didn't develop it enough, but the way they did develop it was maybe too much in other ways. So I don't know. It's an idea. I just don't think it was executed and paid off all that well. But then we get the fade out and then the fade back in, and we get another ending where he goes to pick up his Aston Martin, which I guess is supposed to put the smile and throwback on all our faces, right?
That was the ending for us.
Did he have a picnic basket that he was going to go share with some wine and cheese with her in a park or something?
Did you get the sense that it was Blofeld that she shot when she was a girl?
Yes, you're right. That did come into it, now that I think about it. I think that was implied. Let's have her put a bullet in Blofeld at the end and complete the job.
Yeah.
And now she's a purposeful Bond girl. Now that's why she was in the movie, to do what Bond couldn't do.
There you go. I like that even better.
Well, let me ask you, Mike. There's 24 Bond entries. Where do you rank it?
Oh, jeez.
You've seen them all.
I have. That's a lot to sort of... trying to place that in the pantheon. I don't know. It's definitely lower tier for sure.
Can we slot it as 5, 10, 15, 20, and then 24?
I would put it in the bottom 10 somewhere.
I'd put it in the bottom 5, bottom 3.
Really?
I would.
God, you guys hate this fucking movie. I didn't think it was really that bad. I mean, as far as Daniel Craig movies, it was way better than Quantum of Solace. And Skyfall had its problems too.
I don't know if I agree with you there, Rick. I'm not so sure. I think Quantum has obviously lots of problems.
Where he gets the one up on all of Quantum and takes their photos, that's a better Bond moment than anything that comes to mind, Inspector. A Bond moment, you know what I mean? Where Bond is one step ahead of everybody else and is really being a badass. I do like that moment in Quantum. I do. It's really a cool moment for him.
Yeah.
Has its moments. Not many of them, but it does have them.
It does. It does.
It does.
Yeah.
So bottom 10 for Stevens, bottom 3 for Jansen. I'm going to have to go bottom 5. I'm not sure what's worse than it, though. But it's the new one, you know? I mean, when we had this conversation 3 years ago, it was, what are the ones that are better? You know, so that it's interesting to be kind of playing the other side of the coin. And I guess it's inevitable. I mean, when you take everything that we've discussed for the last couple of hours and you throw it against the wall and you see what sticks, just lightning in a bottle, not being prepared to make the follow-up, waiting so long so that you can get all of the right pieces in place. It was just, it was inevitable. Not only were you not going to remake Skyfall, but you were going to come just painfully short of your goal. And it's weird when people that are professionals don't realize that going in. Or did they?
I can't answer that, because it's not like they didn't have the money and the goodwill to make whatever movie they wanted. They could have done any movie they wanted after Skyfall. And we would have bought... They had a chance to do a License to Kill and get away with it, or a Moonraker. I mean, they could have gone crazy, because Craig had his Spy Who Loved Me moment with Skyfall. That was his biggest one, his third entry. It was his Goldfinger moment, which was the big one in that day. But think about it. Goldfinger and Thunderball are the two biggest Bond movies still today. Attendance, box office, everything. But there was a huge drop-off from Thunderball to You Only Live Twice. What happened? You Only Live Twice is a solid entry, I think people would agree, into the series. Was it just spy fatigue at that time? Because then you had Man from U.N.C.L.E.s and Get Smarts and Our Man Flint's and everything else. Was it just so saturated and people just got tired? I mean, there was a windfall there, but after Thunderball, it did dip. So there's always going to be those peak moments. And, you know, Roger Moore had a peak with Moonraker, which would piggybacked off of Spy Who Loved Me, which they basically remade the same movie. I mean, they took Spy Who Loved Me and remade it into Moonraker. You know, they hadn't planned to do that, but that's how they reacted to the success of Spy Who Loved Me. So here you have, again, a film that's reacting to the success of Skyfall, but unfortunately, I would not call this Daniel Craig's Moonraker, because that would do a disrespect to Moonraker.
I mean, you guys are putting this in, like, you know, Crystal Skull, Spider-Man 3 type of a league. I mean, where you walked out of the theater pissed.
But see, I'm like Moonraker that way. I have a soft spot for that one, even though I recognize it for what it is. But really, there's some stunning stuff in Moonraker. It's, you know, you look at the stunts in this movie, there's nothing better than them jumping out of the airplane in the opening sequence of Moonraker without the parachutes. There's not a single sequence in Spectre that's as good as that, or is as awe-inspiring as that one. Even the cable car sequence in Moonraker is good. Even the boats chase and the waterfall and the hang glider ride off. All of that, to me, has more Bond awe than any of the gags I saw in this one. So I would rank Moonraker higher for that reason alone.
So, boom, number 24 of 24.
Hey, something has to be, right?
Something's got to be last. You're absolutely right.
The writing
right.
was on the wall, and there it is. And you know what I like about this, though? The next installment is so primed. I mean, there is no way they're going to make 25, and that will be number 25 next time out. So I'm in a great place, really, for the next installment.
It's all up here, man.
The awesome thing is that they're going to be on the 25th Bond, which means that what they can do is they can look back at all the previous Bonds and they can do some throwbacks. It's going to be awesome.
Finally, some homages.
Oh, man. You know how long I've been waiting for that in the Bond series?
I know.
A new Beach Boys song?
Oof.
Cause the writing's on the wall.
I came here to kill you.
Youth is no guarantee of innovation. You don't have to worry about me. I'm not going to go chasing him. He's not important. Some unfinished business.
You see that? Gone such a short time, already forgotten.
I'm sorry. That last hand nearly killed me. I've got the village.
down there. Would you mind?
The name's Bond. James Bond.
Vodka martini, shaken, not stirred.
Well, I understand 00s have a very short life expectancy, so your mistake will be short-lived.
Bond. James Bond.
This is the Hollywood Gauntlet.